Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio. You know, shuffle my stuff around here at my desk so I can actually write, work the mouse, work the keyboard. So for those who don't know, this is like the ultimate in multitasking. So I got the keyboard in my left hand, I got the mouse in my right hand, so I have to write, and I got the book there too. So all this stuff is kind of floating around here right now. All right, let's bring on Amber Kemper, who I do not have a theme for yet, but I'm going to work on that. So well, let me just have a little fun here. Because I don't have a theme, but I do have something that I haven't played. In fact, I don't even think Amber's heard this. So let's do our guest of the day when she's actually a regular reporter. And this is for Amber Kemper. Yes, the only college student in America who's up at not only up at 6 o'clock, but ready to do a report. This is fascinating. So I'm really happy. And so Amber came to us by writing a bill. And she just appeared on my website, writeyourlaws.com. And from there, went very quickly to being our constitution reporter. And so here she is. And let's find out what's in the news and how we can relate the news to the constitution with a couple of the bills of rights. How's that sound? You get your own theme music. That was pretty cool. Good morning.
That was cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Your line sounds a little better. We were talking off the air, it still sounds like in a fish tank or something like that. Are you in some containment vessel, some experimental college, you know, project that we don't know about or what are you doing there?
Dorm.
Oh, it's just a dorm. Oh, okay. Yeah. Do they soundproof the walls? You know, do you have the FBI listening? Like I have them listening to my show.
No, I hope not.
You know, and now that I think about it, that's an interesting, this is how things happen. I make jokes, but then I think, well, maybe that's not so funny. It'd be interesting to see if they're, because you know how the FBI is working with Facebook, right? They're taking all our posts and comments and personal messages, and they're reporting them straight to the FBI KGB. Wouldn't it be interesting if you asked your university if they have any affiliations with the FBI? Do they have any student watch programs? And not only your campus, but other campuses across the country. We've got a whole Turning Point USA. Let's see if they're, maybe they can look into this too. Let's check out FBI College. I literally just thought of this. FBI College intrusion, intervention, surveillance, spying, anti-patriotic, anti-American activities, particularly on conservative campuses, Christian campuses, Brigham Young University, for example, Liberty University, Hillsdale. You know, are there any FBI operations? You can ask your member of Congress, you can ask anybody you want, influential friends, you know, people your folks know, anybody. How's that for an idea? That'd be a great project.
Yeah, that is interesting. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I've never thought about it. Have you thought about it at all? I'm just curious.
I have not.
Yeah. Like I say, neither did I until I just started here. Okay. Well, let's see what you got. tell me news. Tell me... we talked off the air about a couple of amendments possibly, so you can do that or you can pretty much report on anything that you want to. But I'm curious, where shall we go this morning?
Yeah, I think we talked about we were going to talk about the Fourth and Fifth Amendment on searches and seizures.
It seems to me there was a raid not too long ago.
about a
current president. Yeah, current president who'd be calling a former president because they don't know any better because they're stupid. But I thought these two might be interesting for us, interesting for us to go over. And then, of course, we can keep going. There's other amendments too. But it's like 4 through 8, if I remember, in the Bill of Rights are all dedicated to the rights of the accused, which is fast. Half the Bill of Rights, or almost half, is strictly on the rights of the accused. That's kind of staggering, which shows how bad things were during the colonial times and how bad the founders thought they were going to be in our country.
Yeah.
And despite these amendments, you know, Trump still got raided. So what do you think about that anyway? Have you talked about that on campus? What's the buzz?
We talked a little bit about it the other day. Have you seen the files that came out that were the stuff that was compensated?
They had some classified stuff, but we don't know if it's classified. They scattered a bunch of things on a floor and took a picture of it. So I don't know if those are real or that's FBI plant material. We don't know what that is.
When I saw the picture of what the documents were, I'm like, okay, what's this classified document? Why is this classified? You know, what's in it that would make it classified, and why does he have it, you know? Like, those types of questions pop into my head, and then it's like, okay, wait. If it's so easy to just classify a document and post it online, you know, what's stopping them from planting it? You know,
yeah.
All you have to do is redact a couple pages of wording, and you have a classified document.
Oh, you can stamp classified on a brownie recipe. Who knows? I mean, you could do anything. Well, here's what I thought, too. As soon as I looked at that picture, you know, I tried to blow it up a little bit. And I'm thinking, you know, anybody with any decent computer technology would be able to blow up that first page and see exactly what's on it. So is not the FBI in their planting of evidence or their obsession with, quote, get Trump, because they have ceased being the Department of Justice and have become the Department of Democrat, you know, persecution of Republicans. You know, that's why I call them the FBI KGB. By releasing that picture, which can be blown up, are they not releasing illegally classified documents?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Trump people, are you listening? We're giving you defenses, Trump people. Trump people, listen. You should listen. They should listen to the show. We just gave them a perfect defense. But, you know.
We also have classified documents that are posted online, but, you know, redacted. Like, it's not, I don't know, it's not, like, super obvious that it's posted online, because that document could also be found online.
Well, do you know how this is kind of a mystery to me? I know a little bit about how documents are classified, but I'm not really well versed in it. But it seems to me that it's you know, they're government officials, and I heard something recently that they will classify things that are embarrassing. They will classify things that just because they can. They will classify, you know, the ability to classify is rather arbitrary, and it's not a really set procedure. The ability to declassify rests with the president and various other folks. But the president has an exclusive ability to declassify anything. And so even if it says classified, he may have declassified those documents. But that's not the point. The point is to try to say, it's like the old, he's got a secret. We know something that, you know, we can't tell you. We know he's got secrets. We can't tell you what they are, but we're going to arrest him anyway. This is classic communist. You know, you're always guilty of something. You know, but I'm not sure how the classification – that might be something you want to work into the show at some point, not today. But if you ever study classifications and kind of report back and say, well, here's how they do it, and this is why it's a bogus system, because, you know, whatever you find. I'd be curious what you find. So now see, we're like 7 minutes in. You've already got two massive projects, if you want.
I almost wonder if we should just ban classifications altogether. Because why does the government need to keep any secrets from us?
That is a fascinating idea. Or, no, I see a need for secrets, but we did a couple of shows. I did one last, we started Monday with the whole idea of the ongoing investigation. And I've reported on this before, but I really got into it Monday. So you might want to take a listen to that show. As soon as someone says something, you know, Cruz asked questions of this FBI. There's a woman who's their assistant deputy special agent. Of course, they're all special, right? Nobody's just an agent anymore. They're special.
Right, yeah.
So our special agents, she was asked, you know, by Ted Cruz and I think Rand Paul and some others at different times, you know, did you have any FBI operatives there January 6th? And she says, I can't answer that question. And, you know, I won't answer that question. I'm like, well, why the hell won't you answer that question? And why didn't Ted Cruz push her on it and say, you have to answer that question? This is oversight. This is your job to answer that question. You know, and the question was, do you have any traitors at the FBI? You know, were there traitors operating against the government of the United States, against the Trump administration, which won a second term? Did you have people there, you know, steering folks into the Capitol and all this kind of stuff? She says, I can't answer. So this is my deduction. I'm curious what you think of my reasoning. So my reasoning is that was the only answer they could give given the situation. If she says, yes, there were FBI operatives, she's admitted to treason. If she says, no, there were not FBI operatives, and of course there were, I mean, Ray Epps pretty much confessed, then she's guilty of perjury. So her choices are treason and perjury. So the only way to not be charged with treason or perjury, or at least be thought of as scum of the earth, you know, and a traitor, is to say that she won't answer because it's an ongoing investigation. I don't think that's good enough. Yeah. I don't accept ongoing investigation. How's my reasoning? Yeah. What do you think?
I completely agree. You know, it's been, 2 years now?
Mm-hmm.
It should be closed.
So maybe there should be a statute of limitation on ongoing investigations, at which point we should be able to find out what they are. Or here's another idea, that you don't have to release the names of witnesses because you want to protect them. If you have a confidential witness, you don't want to, it's like a mafia case. You don't release the names of the witnesses. They get killed. So you don't do that. You don't have to release every shred of exact evidence, but you should be able to say the areas that you're looking into. The FBI should be able to say, they may not have to name the people. I mean, I'm sure we can prosecute them later, but if there were people there that were, FBI involved other than, doing real legitimate FBI stuff, if they're there in any way to invite the crowd, aid the crowd, usher the crowd in, treat it like the price is right, come on down, that should be disclosed, I think.
Yeah.
So
I agree.
So what do you think should be classified? If you had to make a classification system, what kind of things would be classified, and what kind of things do you think are classified now that shouldn't be? I know it's kind of a big question right now, but just speculate for a bit.
I have to look into what all is classified right now.
Okay.
But like you were saying, witness list, that stuff should not be publicly released.
Let me ask you a couple of instances. Go ahead.
If there are documents that pretty much any law hopefully should be published, not redacted.
Well, even drafts of laws, we publish the drafts of our laws here. So everybody knows what we're doing. We keep a legislative record. We keep, and the congressional record is supposed to do that too. They will publish drafts of bills, information, citations, sources of evidence. I mean, Matt Gaetz, our congressman here in the First District in Florida, even published Hunter's laptop. Put that in the congressional record, which I think is kind of funny, actually. We need him back on the show. So Matt Gaetz, if you're listening, which I hope you do every morning, give us a call here, 215-383-3832. We'll see if he used to call. Let me ask a couple of classification questions. I'm thinking the firing mechanism of a nuclear bomb. Would that be something you would classify?
I'm not sure, because not many people have access to a nuclear bomb.
So it
either doesn't need to be public knowledge, or it can be public knowledge because it doesn't pertain to everybody.
But if we publish the firing mechanism for our nuclear bombs, maybe other folks can counter that, hack into it, do something to destroy it. So that to me would be a classifiable item.
Yeah.
How about our negotiating points for the next Abraham Accords in the Middle East?
Yeah, that should probably not be published.
Because?
It can be used against us.
And people might not be free to say what they want to do in private negotiations because they know it might be published. This is why diplomacy has to be done in secret. You come out with your agreements, but you don't talk about how you make them because people would have to be brave in front of all their people, their media, things like that. So I there's a need for classification. How about the number of nuclear weapons we have?
That should probably be classified.
See, I would have that unclassified. But go ahead. Tell me your reasoning. Yeah. Because the enemy already knows. They've already photographed all our missile silos. They've already counted our submarines. They've already checked our airplanes. The satellites have already done the work. They already know how many nuclear weapons we have. So the only people that wouldn't know is the American people. So when I think about classification, is it something that our enemies already know because they have good intelligence and because of Eric Swalwell and Feng Feng and other chain breaks like Brandon, who basically is the Chinese ambassador to the White House, or is it being kept from the American people, or is it being kept for the American people? See, that's the difference. Is it for the American people we're keeping the secret, or is it from the American people? So that's where I come down on classification.
Yeah, that's a good point. If it's to protect the American people, I think it's fine. But if it not, and there's no reason that the American people shouldn't know, then why classify it.
Yeah, I think of 9/11, and there are those that think there were demolition charges at the base of the building. Because why would an airliner bring down a building? Although it did come, I've seen the videos, you know, you can see it coming down from the top, but I don't know if those are genuine videos. I've also seen it drop from the bottom. You know, and Building 7, World Trade Center 7, was never hit by an airplane, and that one fell down too. Should all that be released? Even if it makes the government look bad. Yeah. That's all classified, as far as I know. Yeah. I mean, they've had explanations and things, but the real details, I think a lot, or Flight 800. You know, I still think that was brought down by a missile.
Well, the one that crashed in the field?
No, no. This is Flight 800 was TWA. This is back, this would have been the 90s. See, a bunch of airlines, you know, back when I was flight instructing, they all went broke, which sort of put an end to my airline career. But TWA, Pan Am, Braniff, a bunch of airlines went broke, and they reformed other airlines. Mm-hmm. But this one, it was 747. It took off from New York, and somewhere out over the Atlantic, not too far from Long Island, it blew up and crashed into the ocean. And they said, well, the center fuel tank exploded. I'm like, that's never happened on a 747 previously. It never happened again. Why did it happen on this one airplane when there happened to be like several Navy ships doing a missile exercise right below it? And you say it's the center fuel tank? I don't think so.
Yeah.
But a lot of that information is still classified. So in other words, it's being kept from the American people. It's not being kept for the American people. That's the difference. Hey, let's get into your amendments. Otherwise, we'll never get there. Let's have another comment on that.
Yeah. So Article 4 is about all that being searched and seized. You know, the whole purpose it was written is so that way the colonists wouldn't be searched by the British. You know,
let's just read it and tell me what you think. Yeah, good. And I think if you get a little closer to your phone, I mean, you're not bad in there. It still sounds like you're talking in a bubble, you know, like the cone of silence or something. But, yeah, so let's start with the fourth, and we'll see if we can get through the fifth. And tell me what you think. How about all this came about?
The fourth or the fifth? Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. Yeah, keep going.
Oh, okay. So the fourth says the right of the people to be secure in their persons, house, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue, but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. So it's not saying I can go into the house because I think there's something there that might be illegal. No. You have to know what you're going for and where it's located in the house to be able to go in and grab it.
So how do you answer the question, if you've got nothing to hide, what are you worried about?
Oh, that's true, but you have a constitutional right to your privacy.
Exactly.
You know,
good answer.
You don't have to have people coming in and raiding your house.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't have to prove, you know, that we don't have anything to hide. It's just that it's not on us to prove we don't have something. And quite frankly, privacy means everybody has something to hide because that's our right to hide. We don't have to open our lives to the government. They have no right to do that. So maybe you probably know more about colonial history than I do, but what was going on at the time? Do you know what the British were doing in terms of why this amendment came about, why it was so important to make search and seizure very specific and give us very specific rights of prohibitions on the government? I know a little bit about it, but you may know more. So I'm just curious. Did you look into how they were searching and seizing back then?
I'm not sure exactly how they were doing it, but I know that they were doing it enough to where the American people were fed up and sick of it, you know, coming in and either taking their stuff or making a mess, you know, coming into their privacy. That's not, they did not like that. So they created this amendment.
Yeah, it's almost like they assumed everybody was guilty of something and they wanted to search your house to see if they could find something you were guilty of, and if they absolutely found nothing, you had to prove your innocence, and that goes against our presumption of innocence, where it's on the burdens on the government to prove us guilty of something. I think that's the fundamental difference, as I look at it, that most countries of the world are like this. You have to prove your innocence. They assume you're guilty until you prove yourself innocent. That's what separates us from almost every other country. We are assumed to be innocent. However, that seems to be changing.
Right.
Let's take Donald Trump. Is he presumed to be innocent or presumed to be guilty?
Ever since he decided to run for office, it's been guilty.
By who?
By the Democrats.
Democrats. But Democrats can't run into his home and raid it. So what's different? Why? How can they, you know, who has the ability to do this, to presume you guilty and then do something about it?
It would be the FBI.
Yeah. And the FBI is in the Department of Justice. Now, when we stop laughing, you know, about that, it takes government to be able to take your rights away. If an individual showed up at your house and said, "I want to search your house," what would you say to them? Once you stop dropping F-bombs, get the hell out of here. Go away. So an individual shows up, bunch of individuals, you know, the PTA, the Parent Teachers Association shows up at your house. You gonna let them in? No. Okay. You know, I don't know, pick an organization. I'm getting kind of silly now. But it really takes government, the force of government, to put fear into people. You know, if the Girl Scouts show up and want to raid your house and then sell you cookies, do you care? Are you going to let them in? You might buy some cookies. But they're no threat to you. So we're talking about a government threat here. So the prohibition on that government threat is the Fourth Amendment. Is it being followed these days? What do you think?
No. It's not.
So, young person, having to live in this country for the next many decades, or maybe you'll choose to go somewhere else, but I don't think so. But what do you want to do about this?
People like me, who the next generation is ours, we need to be involved in politics. We need to be writing our laws. You know, we need to be doing all of these things to make sure that we have a country that the founders wanted, to make sure that our freedom does not change.
Yeah. What do you want to do with the FBI?
Just abolish it. Just get rid of it.
Oh, well, let's give her a round of applause. We're in the right wavelength. See, this is why I wanted you on the show. Here we go. So here's the question. And this is a rhetorical question. I love it. This is one of those questions I already know the answer to, and you do too. But in asking it, it allows you to present a political point of view. This is a strategy, and you can use this too. Is there any place in the Constitution that authorizes a federal police force?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the FBI itself is literally an unconstitutional agency.
Governmental body, yeah. I read something somewhere, I don't remember, but it was saying that of the governmental agencies or employees, only like 20% of them are actually needed. You know, we have 80% government employees that are employed by the government that we don't need. You know.
Yeah, look up... Yeah. Do you know where that study was? That'd be a great report.
That'd be something
you could present. Yeah. Well, you know, maybe next week, or if you think of it, or if it comes up. But that'd be something great to go over. So you're not limited to constitutional issues, but that is actually a constitutional issue. Let me ask you this: if 80% of the government is what we call non-essential, remember when they have a government shutdown? If you remember any of the government shutdowns, a lot of people go home. They get laid off because they were non-essential. And of course, all of us are saying, "Well, wait a minute. If they're non-essential, why don't you just keep them home? Fire them. Get rid of them. If they're not essential, why are you going to bring them back?"
Yep.
So if they're not essential, then they're unconstitutional because they're not authorized. They're not supposed to be there. So here's the thought. 80% of our employees in the federal government are not necessary. How much of the budget do you think that represents?
That's quite a bit of the budget.
Yeah. Sophia, here's your third project. Here's your third project. We still got 5 minutes to go. If you find the entire cost, you can probably find this, of labor, what are the costs of all the salaries, benefits, pensions, maybe not pensions because that's going to get unfunded mandates, but the salaries, benefits, the current cost of the federal government workforce, and then multiply that by 80% and subtract it or multiply it by 20%. So you'll have the cost of what it is now and the cost of what it should be if only 20% of the people that are necessary or were employed, and that would be our savings.
Yeah.
Yeah. Number crunching. Are you good with numbers? I'm not. Okay. All right. Well, let's get it.
Take notes.
Take notes on our podcast. We got three projects for you. Let me get back to the fourth here, because there's something I really wanted to point out. The right of the people to be secure. What does that mean, the right of the people to be secure?
You know, we have the right to protect our property and our persons. You know, we shouldn't need to be afraid of getting, you know, government bodies coming in and raiding our house.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, I think you're absolutely right.
We have the right to protect ourselves.
So not only do we not have to worry about somebody to hide, because that's their problem, not ours, we can be secure in the knowledge that they're never come into our house unless they have a warrant and probable cause supported by oath or affirmation. Yeah. So nobody in this country should worry about a government official, because we don't care about the Girl Scouts. Well, we do, but we want their cookies. We don't expect them to raid our homes. But we don't expect the government to come in unless, you know, we're secure. We don't, this shouldn't affect us at all. Now we're not talking about guilty criminals who are, you know, bringing fentanyl and stashing illegals and things like that. That's different. Yeah, you people should be afraid. Get the hell out of my country. You know, that's first thing. But the right of the people to be secure. So they don't say the right of people to be safe. You notice, it says secure.
Right. Right.
So I find words fascinating in their persons. Well, what is our person? If we're secure in our person, what does that mean?
In our ability to protect ourselves.
How about in terms of government search and seizure?
Yeah.
If we're secure in our person, can we be seized arbitrarily?
No, without a warrant.
So the government, so to me, this means that we are, to be secure in our person means the government cannot seize us. They cannot arrest us. They can't just arbitrarily take us, grill us for 25 hours, you know, without food and water, and just to try and beat out a confession. I mean, that used to happen.
Right.
It even happened in this country, you know, with law enforcement. They think, you know, there was a time, it's better now, but there was a time, you know, probably late 18, early 1900s where, you know, the old rubber hose treatment, that really happened. And the lights in the face, that really happened. And the term beating out a confession, in other words, they beat you until you confess whether you did it or not. That really happened.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So if you're secure in your person, you cannot be seized. Your person cannot be taken unless these conditions are met, which we call due process.
Right. Which is Amendment 5.
That's true. So they work together. I think some tells me we're not going to get to 5 today. All right, let's go. Persons,
right, yeah.
Here's another one. How about our houses? Did that apply to Trump? just happens to be there, right? Isn't that fascinating? What do you think?
Yeah.
Was Trump secure in his house?
Yeah. No.
No?
I almost wonder if they purposefully raided his house. He wasn't home. Or when he wasn't home.
Yeah, and where was the Secret Service? Why did the Secret Service let the FBI in? I mean, they both had guns.
Right.
Why wasn't there a standoff? It's like, no, we're going to call Donald Trump. We're going to wait till he gets here, and then we're going to let your butts come in, maybe, if you have a warrant, maybe.
Yeah, right.
I mean, they screwed up, too. Pianchi, he's on the line, too. You want to talk to Amber?
Well, I heard what you said about getting rid of the FBI. I don't think that they entirely need to be gotten rid of. I think they need to be reformed. There's the things that the FBI does very well that you still need, like the espionage agents that's here in the country. You got child traffickers. You got corrupt government officials, mayor, voted all the persons. you know, things like that. So they need to be highly
reformed.
Well, those
can be done by the states, right?
Yeah, but see, the states don't have the ability to coordinate. Like they
sure
have
they do.
Raids that's coming. They have raids that goes on simultaneously across the country. And then, too, you at government level, local or state government, you got corruption. Like in St. Louis, you got the three alder person that's been federally indicted for taking bribes. Well, you never would have got that out of working with local level, especially local police. And you probably wouldn't got it out of the state, neither.
Amber?
But if you, I think if you get rid of the, first of all, the body's completely unconstitutional. There's no warrant for it. Second, if we completely get rid of it, that forces the state to take the place and to have those mechanisms in place that the FBI did. So now they're taking that spot, and they have to, because there's no other government body there to do that besides the state.
Okay, but you don't have – a state can't control another state, right? States are separate countries. So you have to have a federal authority that has – that's over the state. And the problem
is – this is so different
FBI,
than every position you've ever taken. This is such a contradiction. We got to hold it up here because we've got Sherilyn. I want to hear all about her lobbying in Washington. Amber, we may have to get you a longer time. we'll talk about that off the air. Maybe there's an hour for you that we can sneak in sometime, depending on your schedule, or not, or maybe just even start. Well, we'll figure it out. But let's hold it for now because we got to get back. I want to pick up Fourth Amendment again. Houses, papers, effects, and some other things like that. Shirley, do you have a quick comment on this, and then we'll get to your entire story.
No, I just poked in, so I don't really know what we're talking about. So you
okay.
Can just pass me by on this one.
All right. Okay. Well, let's get to Shirley's report. Amber, any closing thoughts? Anything happening? Favorite groups you want to highlight? Any information you want to give?
Nothing I can think of.
Okay. Sounds good. All right, let's get to Shirley. And thank you for your report. And again, it's, you know, whatever you think you're going to talk about, it never quite works out exactly that way just because. But I really appreciate the fact that you can think on your feet. And all these things I throw at you, you just kind of bounce them right back, which is great. All right, let's get to Shirley.
When one is faced with a crisis, you find your true character. How you react to such an emergency can determine the rest of your life. Two paths present themselves for you to choose. One leads to tragedy. The other leads to becoming a new person. Shirley Wattrall, a survivor of a dangerously abusive relationship, is that new person. She's the author of Heels to Holster. She is a firearms instructor, motivational speaker, women's empowerment advocate, and a reporter for Action Radio. So now, here is the DC Project, Women and Guns, with Shirley Wattrall.
And let's add one more category to her long list of accomplishments, lobbyists. Okay, tell us the story. What happened? How'd it go?
It went great. We do like to be known as advocates. Apparently, lobbyists has more of a has a party differentiation, and we're nonpartisan. Because yeah, I learned that we're more of an advocate, not a lobbyist.
Which party are lobbyists, and which party are lobbyists?
What?
Well, you said it has a more of a party affiliation. I'm just wondering which party are known as lobbyists. As opposed to advocates.
We're not. That's why we're advocates. We're nonpartisan.
Oh, okay. It belongs to any political party. So political parties lobby and citizens groups advocate.
Right. Yeah,
okay.
That's more of a lobbyist type thing. So we're more of an advocate because our
okay.
project is nonpartisan. But no,
okay.
it was a lot of walking.
Yeah, tell me everything. So from impressions beforehand to the actual stuff to what you think now, I'd be curious.
We met with mostly AIDS mm-hmm. or their assistants. I think maybe three or four legislators that were actually there.
Mm-hmm.
We met with them, spoke with them. It was educational in the fact that I learned that you never know who's listening. You never know who might be hearing your story and you're not even talking to them. In some cases, we weren't put into a meeting room, and their workers or aides were working on computers, and they heard the story and what we were talking about. And later on, they came. They just happened to run into us because at every building, if you're outside, you have to be escorted in. You can't just walk in through security. You have to have someone come down, get you, and walk you through security, which I guess is something new since it used to be, and they're hoping that that will go away eventually. Because, you know, it's a lot of time. Everybody you got to meet, you take them down, go downstairs, pick them up, and take them wherever. But this one person ended up coming downstairs. They were waiting to meet someone else, and it was a couple hours later. And we were waiting for someone to come get us, and they came over and they said, you know, keep doing what you're doing. And they heard me talk about my story, and, you know, and it was a good thing. It was a positive thing. And it was, when I heard them say that, I was like, wow, that's good to know. That was very important. I'm glad you told us that, because sometimes not everybody is accepting of what we do and supporting the Second Amendment and not taking guns away from us. So when someone comes up that might not, their boss might not agree with us totally and tells you that. So you never know. You never know who's listening.
Well, it also shows you how fast word travels around Washington, D.C., too.
And you never know whose life you might touch, too. You know,
yeah,
it's not even in the group that you're talking to. So that was a big one.
Well, let's go back a little bit for folks that don't know exactly what tell about the group and why you were there, and because you weren't here. And we have new listeners. We have Algeria, you know, has checked into our board now, and Uganda's back.
True.
So we're getting some interesting countries. So yeah.
Usually I do start with that, and I did not. So DC Project is the nationwide group of women fighting to preserve our Second Amendment. We believe that education is the key to safety. We don't need more gun control bills, and we want to educate our youth as well as to firearm safety, as well as adults. And we support other organizations that are like Hold My Guns and Suicide Prevention, as well as Faster Saves Lives, which is educating administrators and teachers on trauma, how to handle trauma situations, as well as being able to defend themselves with a firearm if they have a active shooter come in. And also kid safety, which is about educating children on firearm safety. So what happens normally once a year, we had 60 ladies. You get one person from every state, and there's only a few states where we're missing a state director. We meet in Washington.
Are they liberal
D.C.
states? Are they liberal states or tiny states or what? Or just arbitrary?
I don't know which ones. I think there's four or five that we don't have any right now. You know, person had to go off and, you know, life does what a life does, and they have to get out of the situation for now. But, next time I'll have to find out. Maybe we have a listener out there that wants to come be a state director.
Mm-hmm.
But,
yeah.
So we meet in Washington, D.C., and we had 12 groups, and you get four or five. Well, but four, some had five. I'd say an average four people per group,
mm-hmm.
and you're in from different states. And you, before you get there, you make appointments with your legislators. You try to make appointments with your House representatives, your senators from the states that's in your group. So in my group, we had Georgia, South Carolina, and Alabama.
You were kind of clustered in it. You wouldn't have a group of California, Michigan, you know, Tennessee, and Arkansas, for example. You wouldn't be that spread. You'd kind of get them closer together, or did not necessarily go that way.
You know what? I didn't really pay attention to that, but while we're chatting, I can also find that out.
No, it's not critical. I was just curious.
What was that?
No, I was just saying it would make, if I were planning it, I would group the states in clusters so that you had, you know, so you get to know your adjacent state directors, and so that people in Congress, you know, in the same, because a lot of times the folks in the South are going to think more similarly than if you had Michigan, you know, South Carolina, Rhode Island, you know, Arizona,
so,
you know, in the same,
so
in the
here,
same
here's,
group.
Here's, you've got to, one.
Yeah.
Here's another one. It's Pennsylvania, Vermont, New Hampshire, and West Virginia. Let's see.
So fairly northeast.
I don't know who that interesting. Oh, here was the one out west. We have, who do we have? Louisiana, Colorado, Mississippi, Arizona, and Kentucky.
Kind of spread, but, you know, California's probably big enough
as
its own group. We should probably have four people from California alone. They got like, what is it, 55 electoral votes, so they probably have, probably 53 members of Congress, two senators.
Okay, here's California. We have Washington, California, Arkansas.
Oh, that's interesting.
So, anyway, so they put us in groups and you make your appointments.
Mm-hmm.
The hardest part of making your appointments is finding out who to contact. We have someone that helped us get some information. She works up there. But,
mm-hmm.
the turnover, I guess, is pretty quick, pretty big over there. So never know who the scheduler is. So the hardest part is trying to get a hold of the right person. And so I ended up getting, we met with both our Florida senators, Scott and Rubio.
Impressions? What do you think? Wait, can you have a quick impression of each of them?
I mean, I didn't meet with them personally. We met with their legislative aides.
Okay.
And they
staff?
Were happy to hear about us. You know, it's funny. I don't think anybody actually had heard about us before.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay. So that's good right there.
Yeah. So even that part right there, just opening up the doors to that we are out there, we are available to help them if they need testimony or if they need just a visual or they need our opinions on upcoming bills or anything like that. So it was good to that, you know, that they're like, oh, we didn't know you're available out there. Because what happens is when you get these mass killings, organizations that are backed by millions of dollars, of course, they get paid to go up there. And they get pounded right after any mass killing with, like, the little, you know, red shirt folks run up there. And they meet with all the legislators. And they have to get, you know, they get pounded by them. And one time we were talking, I think it was in Georgia, I forget what senator, one of their aides or the legislators. And he was telling us about that because we just get bombarded. All the anti-gunners come in and they just, anytime that happens. And she goes, well, would it be beneficial if we came in? And he goes, yeah. It'd be nice to know that someone's there backing us because, you know, they get bombarded by the antis, but they don't hear from the pro Second Amendment people.
That's good advice. You know, it's important. People forget it's easier to complain than to support. And it is just as important, if not more important, to support people when they do the right thing, because it's very easy to complain. But if you support them, and if, you know, 90% of the country is for the Second Amendment and 10% is making the noise of 90%, you know, that's going to be the problem. You know, people, the perception is disproportionate amongst a louder minority.
Because sometimes I'm talking to people and they go, oh, no, they're not going to take away our Second Amendment. No, they're chipping away at it. People are I think, a little more lax because they don't think it can happen. So they don't make their voices heard. And that's another thing that we have to promote. Make those phone calls. They do make a difference. As we're talking to people, they do. You know, when we call them and they're getting calls from their constituents, that makes a difference when they're voting. And they know who's behind them.
Yeah. Did you get a chance? You might have talked about this, but the credit card companies are now. In fact, Jim told us about this, and I heard on a news story. Jim's on here now. He wants to talk to you too, but we want to hear all about your lobbying. But was that issue too late for your lobbying, or have you heard about this?
No, we talked about it. I mean,
what happened?
So we kind of threw it in there. There are some they're putting together a they're putting together a letter and sending it off to the credit card companies as to who's authorizing them to do this. And there's some kind of letter that's going around that they're, I don't know how many signatures they had on it. They're working on getting different signatures to find out who authorized it and more information about how they can, them doing that.
I heard
that
from the news.
I don't know.
Elizabeth Warren's name came up somehow. It's Elizabeth Warren is connected to this somehow. Her name came up as a possible source of it, but she can't. She can't make a policy by herself. She can't. She can't decree this. This is crazy. Well, let's ask Jim. See what he knows about it. I'm kind of curious. Jim, welcome back to the show. Here we have
Thanks,
our lobbyist.
Rick,
oh, excuse me, advocate.
Here.
Advocate. I gotta get my language straight. Advocate Shirley Wachtel. There we go.
Hey Jim, how you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you today, Shirley?
Oh, it's trying to regroup and take off. I'm heading off to, where am I heading off to today? I got in yesterday and heading off to Titusville today.
Warrior
woman at the police museum in Titusville.
Nice. Very nice.
How's that compared to Washington?
Oh, I didn't know they had tunnels from building to building, which is kind of cool.
Ooh, you got to ride the subway? Did you get in those little cars between the underneath the Capitol?
No, we didn't go to the Capitol.
Oh.
Some got to tour the Capitol, but we had meetings. We averaged about 6-7 meetings a day, 2 days.
Mm-hmm, that's good.
14-15 meetings. Mm-hmm. And we have to also allow for walk time because, of course, they're never even – we try to do the House in the morning and the Senate in the afternoon, if at all possible, when we're making our appointments. But even then, you might have a House that's in one building and then a meeting in one building and a meeting in another one. So,
change. See, this is where women have to wear sensible shoes when you're lobbying, advocating. It's so ingrained in my thing. See, I don't think of it as a bad word. But anyway, when I was an intern there back in the 80s, we could ride. Literally, the underground tunnels, you know, between the House and the Senate with the senators and representatives. They didn't care. I mean, it was that friendly and that open. Nobody had a problem because we were harmless little interns anyway. But yeah, we got to talk to them. We got to ride in the elevator sometimes, the Senate and House elevators. We had full access to the Capitol. We could drop in anybody's office, you know, especially once we got known a little bit, you know, from some of the folks that were there. You were there a few months. And, of course, as I've told Jim several times, you know, the interns are the ones scarfing all the sandwiches at the congressional receptions at night because we didn't have any money. So we'd take the free food. But it was it was pretty funny. But, yeah, so – but now the access is much different. But just another question, just a quick advocating thing. Have you guys all sent out thank you notes for the people, you know, please contact me if you have further questions, that kind of stuff? Have you guys did
oh,
talk
yeah.
about follow up?
Yeah, I'm sure everybody else has, but I stayed there and spent time with my nephew I hadn't seen since COVID, so I did not not done my homework yet. But have we're gonna be sending out email, thank you emails and actual cards as well. Those are very important. And
we got contacts now.
I'm also
contacting them. Yeah, go ahead.
All our leave behind stuff that we left behind, we're gonna attach that too, just in case someone else gets a hold of it, and they have a copy of other information about us.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Jim, these folks are organized. What do you think? I'm impressed.
Oh, yeah, they're incredibly organized. They do amazing work. I will never stop singing the praises of DC Project. They do an incredible amount of good for the Second Amendment up on Capitol Hill.
Mm-hmm. And it's I don't know how they did it. You have, because we had other people, like in Florida, we were supposed to have two other people, me as the state director and other ones that had their own personal story. And so we had some extra people. So a total about 60 women there. I don't know how they organize. It just floors me. So you have a hotel, you got to get everybody a room, get everybody paired up, you got to get your teams together, your teams are getting your appointments. And then you have a meeting right before, the night before, prepping you, and then we made rally signs, and then you organize a rally, and then you have the 2A caucus, which was organized by Congressman Massey and Lauren, I can never remember her last name.
Boebert.
Lauren. Yes, thank you. So then you have a 2A caucus reception on one night. It was go, 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 go. It was, I don't know how they did it. It was pretty amazing. And then for our rally, because there's construction being done at the Capitol. So where we usually have it on the lawn, where you have the Capitol in background, there's construction. So then they had us what's called Area 12, which is way out somewhere around that block. And so then they said, oh, we're going to have it at the Supreme Court building. Let's see if we can do that. So we moved it over there, and they have really weird rules. Okay, so you can have a rally, but you can't be on the marble steps. You have to be, you know, on the concrete. And then they also were doing, we had a photographer, and they were doing videos and everything, and they wanted to do sound bites. So then you have to fit that into your schedule, too. You meet with a photographer, and then you do your sound bites. Well, they were doing those at the Supreme Court. And then the security guards come over because the guys have, you know, big cameras. And they say, no, you can't do that. You cannot have your camera. You cannot be taking any photos on the steps. You have to be down on the sidewalk. And apparently there's also a rule that you have to have a tripod. It has to be on the grass, not on the sidewalk. And but you can take a video of your iPhone on the steps. And then they found out there was some kind of permit. That apparently they had a permit for some other areas, but not a permit for in front of the Supreme Court. So there's a lot of hoops you got to jump through. I don't know how they did it, but
well, it's a lot of BS for a freedom of the press First Amendment case right there. What do you mean you can't take here? You can't do this. You can't do that. It's just, you know, yeah, that's weird. But
and then we couldn't do our picture. We wanted to do our group picture. You can do a group picture in front, but you can't be up on the steps because then I guess somehow they figure that means the Supreme Court is backing you or something. I wasn't there for the whole explanation, but I went, oh, there's just a lot of rules around here.
Well, there are, but it's interesting that, I mean, the Supreme Court, you know, issues opinions on cases. They don't support groups. So I don't know how people can make that inference. I had a question, though, because you're talking about a women's group and being effective. Did you notice a difference in any kind of treatment between the women and the men staffers that you talked to?
No.
Okay.
The only
That's
ones,
good.
There were some that were not pro Second Amendment program, and you kind of got the drift that they were Oh yeah, we agree. They were just giving you the canned answers. They weren't sincere. You kind of felt that. But what I do think is very important to note that when we do have women with personal stories, it has an impact because I saw, you know, sometimes even the ones that really didn't want to be listening to us. And then when I told part of my, started telling my story, their attitude changed a little. So the fact that a lot of our women do have personal stories of either a loved one being shot in a gun-free zone or, you know, raped and had to defend themselves, domestic violence, survivors of domestic violence, any of that does make more of an impact, I believe. It makes a strong impact on whoever's listening, and it kind of gets their attention. I mean, we even had one person that I didn't think it was going to go well. We he let us into the cafeteria. I was like,
oh.
Okay, we don't even get time in the office.
That was your meeting place?
Meeting room.
Yeah,
that was our meeting place. And I'm going, oh, this was our last one. We had one Friday morning before the rally. And I'm like, oh, this is, I thought it was going to be the worst. It was the best because he ended up, well, you know, he was really attentive when I told my story. And we had another lady in the group that had a story of how one of her relatives was not in a good space and they got involved with Hold My Guns. And Hold My Guns isn't just about finding.
Who are they?
You.
I'm not familiar with them.
So if you're in a situation when you don't feel comfortable having your firearms around and you want to voluntarily have someone hold them for you while you go through whatever you're going through, could be a court thing, could be a, you know, just depression. So they get a hold of a gun store, and then they transfer your guns to the FFL there, and they hold your guns until you are feeling better. and you're ready to, you know, if you're into depression or whatever's going on in your life, or maybe you have a bunch of people in your house or whatever the situation, they will hold your guns for you without any mm-hmm.
traveling.
You know,
you could be traveling outside the country for extended time.
Exactly. Or,
yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Anything like that. And they also provide assistance in if someone's going through depression, how to talk to them, how to help them. And they use this person used their service, because I don't want to give names because it's, you know, that's not really important.
No.
They used the service and they were able to talk to the person, and they finally said, you know what, I don't feel comfortable with my firearms, so having them in the house right now. So they had the hold your guns, and they transferred them somewhere, and the person ended up getting help and is feeling better. So, because we know that suicide is a high rate when it comes to using a firearm to commit suicide. So we're also advocating for helping these people and helping anyone that's going through a tough time. And when we went through all the different organizations that we support, he was impressed by that. It was hard to hear, even though we found a little corner. It was still a lot of background noise. And also he was wearing a mask, so I'm going to have to... I haven't read our recap. After every meeting, you do a recap and you submit it. We're submitted so the board can review it, and you know, people that were sitting closer could hear better. But he was impressed by the fact that we supported all these different organizations for gun safety in schools, you know, educating our children, and all this stuff. But also he was impressed that we were involved in judiciary committees, doing hearings, just the way we were organized. So this is someone that I thought was going to be, you know, we don't have time
for
you.
Well, you both broke through stereotypes. You broke through, I mean, their stereotype of gun people is, you know, Duck Dynasty, you know, camo and pickup trucks and shotguns. That's all gun people are. And you broke through the anti-gunners, so they hate everybody. They want to. They're all like Bloomberg. And this is something that's kind of magical about Washington. Despite all its problems, despite all its hassles, sometimes you talk to people as people, and you start talking one-on-one, and even if it's a cafeteria or someplace else, and you make these breakthroughs, you make these connections with people that you didn't necessarily think you're going to agree with. That's the best of Washington. And when that happens, now that's something kind of that's pretty special. So congratulations for that. And that's definitely a contact I would keep. There's something about having adversity with someone that if you break through that, it's stronger than someone you might have agreed with automatically just because you have the same orientation. At least that's what I find. I want to get to Jim and Pianchi to see if they have questions for you too before we get to Jim's report. Go ahead, Shirley.
Yeah, I was just going to say that was one of my, those two were my highlights. People that I didn't know I thought was going bad went really good. And then at the end he goes, you know what? I am recently married, and I'm really concerned about he moved out of the city. We're concerned about their safety, so he's actually considering taking firearms class. So I'm like, contact me.
Isn't that amazing?
I'll find you an instructor in D.C.
Yeah, well, so let us help you out. Yeah, the Bloomberg's not going to help you. You know, moms against safety or moms against life. We can rename them, but they're not going to help them. So this is fascinating. Let's get Pianchi and then Jim, whose report's going to start in a couple of minutes anyway. Pianchi, do you have any questions for Shirley?
Organize, teach, inform, do it, then do it, and do it again.
Sounds like a brochure.
That's,
yeah.
That's
or a bumper sticker. Yeah.
Yeah. There you go.
Okay. Jim?
No, I don't know that I have any questions. I just would like to put out to the listeners out there, you know, if you are looking for a Second Amendment group that is really working nationally to influence laws in this country, you can't find a better group than DC Project. And if you are a woman who is very interested in the Second Amendment, especially if you have a story of your own to tell, then please reach out to the DC Project. They would love to hear your story. They would love to put you in front of people that can make a difference in protecting your Second Amendment rights.
So let's get your contact information right now after that amazingly wonderful statement by Jim. So how do people find you?
Okay. You can, if you're interested, like Jim said, you can want to join DC Project or help us by making a donation. Go to dcproject.info. If you are interested in contacting me, you can email me at Shirley, S-H-I-R-L-E-Y, W-A-T-R-A-L, @gmail.com. And if you have any questions, feel free to contact me. And I can't believe that half hour went by so quickly.
We had a good story.
This is Shirley.
Yeah.
This is Shirley reporting for DC Project, Women and Guns, and Action Radio.
There we go. She's so good at this now. It's great. First of all, congratulations. And I'm really glad you had this experience to go up there. And if you can keep those contacts, and I'd love to have all the state directors. You know, it would take us probably a couple of years to do this, but I'd love to have all the state directors on the show at some point.
I'll work on that. And also, I didn't get a chance to tell you about the rally. Of course, we
had tell me about the rally. Then I got my finger on the button for Jim's report. Oh, of course we got time.
Okay.
Derek's not here, so we got a couple of extra minutes at the bottom of the half hour. All right, go ahead.
Well, I did find out I was speaking at the rally.
Ooh.
And it was like, yeah.
Video? Video? We got a video? We got video?
You know what? I haven't found anybody that videoed my speech.
What? Oh, no.
Everybody else is, you know, someone did like the very tail end of it. And I'm like, this is that weird. I didn't ask anybody to. I figured somebody would have videoed it. But of course, the camera people, I'm sure, did the whole thing. But that was funny. I wanted someone, I've been asking around, anybody video this? And I couldn't even find a picture. I'm like,
that's
happens
hysterical.
When you first went up, I guess. But anyway, I revised it four times because it went from, you know, 10 minutes, 5 minutes to 3 minutes. You know, time kept going down. It's getting hot. Make sure he's short and to the point.
Yep.
So, yeah, so I was the first one up there, and yeah, that went fine, even though it's not anywhere that it shows that I actually did. There's no proof of it, but I did.
See if you can find a video and post it to our Action Radio Gun Group because we all want to see.
Yeah,
if
I do.
See some of the speeches.
Yeah, like
and
I said,
yeah.
I think. The only one I found was the last statement I made. You know, you got that. And I went, well, it's better nothing. It shows
that
I
want the teal. We want the teal tidal wave. We want to see you all.
Yeah, because we had
teal
rally
suit.
Signs and everything else. But then there's the second speaker. And the third speaker, she's really, you know, an older person, and she's real quiet. Then we get this heckler. He comes on his bicycle, and he's got his, you know, those blowhorn thingies, and he's hollering and he's screaming, oh, Jesus loves you and all this stuff. And like, yeah, okay, we're cool with that.
That's
yeah, we'll go
yeah.
with that. And then he's swearing up a storm. I'm going, what? He just,
oh, no.
And then sometimes he's just screaming. He's just making noise, just disrupting. And some of the ladies said, oh, yeah, we saw him as we walked back and forth. And I'm like, we wonder if he's actually being paid to disrupt any type of group that's gathering.
Did you ask him?
But he's screaming and hollering and screaming and doing all that stuff. And then finally we just kind of ignored him. And some of the ladies just went over there and just stood there and just looked at him. I mean, I don't know if he was homeless or what, but he was just screaming. He was just making noise. And then the next speaker, she's the one that tried to get on here. I'm still going to get her on. She's running for house in Kansas. And
okay.
He starts singing Jesus Loves You. So she just, the whole group broke into the song and started singing Jesus Loves You. So it was, and then finally he just went away. I guess he figured out he's not going to change what we're doing. And since we're singing along with him, it wasn't as much fun since we weren't, you know, we're upset. We were joining him in the song. But anyhow, we always have heckler. That was my first experience with any type of rally where you have a heckler like that.
Yeah.
But that was it.
Now, see, I'd walk up and ask him, you know, how many have they been working with the FBI, just to freak him out. Just, you know, that'd be a question. It'd be something interesting to find out. All right, let's get to Jim.
Out of the forests of Virginia to the swamps of southern Florida comes a great man who carries a big gun, probably a Desert Eagle 50 caliber. He served our nation in the military. He protected the citizenry in law enforcement. And now he is a director of Florida Carry, trying to make the Second Amendment, as written, a reality for all Americans. He is Jim Dice with the Second Amendment Report for Action Radio. So now let me ask the perennial question. Good news or bad news? Or both? That seems to be the
Greg,
center.
In the Second Amendment world, especially with this administration, it's always a mixed bag. So,
yeah, no kidding. All right.
Do one thing before we let Shirley get away. Hopefully she's still on. Are you still there, Shirley?
Yeah, I'm here.
Awesome. So I don't know if Shirley has ever heard this story before, but if you ever get the heckler very similar to yours, but with who comes up with the statement, Jesus didn't need a gun, why do you? The best response I've ever heard to that was, you're right, Jesus didn't need a gun, and look what happened to him. His government took him out and publicly nailed him to a cross.
Ooh, that's good.
Stuff your lines into your brain and always have them for those occasions. That's a great one. I never heard that before. That's perfect.
So anyway, I thought that would be a good one for Shirley to have in her back pocket.
Yes, advocating points. I was going
to
say lobbying points.
I'm going to hang on to that one.
Yep. Well, and sometimes you can think of things too, because a lot of times the legislators and the staff, they'll ask you the same questions over and over again. And if you can kind of refine and sharpen your answers, you can save debating time and get more information in. So that's all part of the strategy. But you'll get better at that with more and more practice, just like, you know, reporting on the show here. You know, if you want to have some fun, listen to your first recording, or maybe even first and second one. Hey, listen, we all find our voice, so that's interesting. All right, Jim.
All right. So since we talked about the Visa, MasterCard, and Amex categorizing firearms purchases a little earlier, some, I guess you could call good news on that front. First of all, very close to home for the three of us in Florida. Florida's chief financial officer, Jimmy Patronis, issued a statement telling the major credit card companies, Visa, MasterCard, and American Express, that they should not make up any kind of corporate watch list of gun owners, and that his office would pursue action to defend customers if they tried to do so.
That's good news.
Good news from him. And related to that, there was a group of, I think it was 21, 2, something like that, Republican attorneys general who sent a letter to those three companies urging them to rescind their plans to use the merchant categories, and also telling them that should they abuse that merchant category, that those attorneys general would file suit and take action in their states.
Good. That's good. That's
so,
a damn business.
Little bit of good news.
This is a good thing. Yeah.
And
sure.
One of those is Florida, because I believe it was Congressman Doobie that told us about the letter that you're talking about, that there were a number of them were getting signed and sent off.
Did you meet with Greg Stubbe or one of his staff? Because he's a good guy.
Met with him.
Oh.
He was one of the personal ones. And I thought, oh, that was cool. Yeah, he was a good one.
Impressions, what do you think?
Oh, he was very, very personable, very his wife knew one of the people on our group, and that, I guess, kind of how it helped out. But very personable, very pro-Second Amendment. He was a good one. It was a pleasure meeting him.
So, you know, that's one of your most...
I did a quick meeting at the 2A caucus, said hello to Pat Kamek. A lot of the Congress legislators didn't go to that because some kind of vote that was supposed to happen the next day, they canceled it, so everybody was flying home, so they weren't sticking around Thursday night.
Huh. But Greg Stubbe, I'm particularly interested in that because I've heard good things. I've seen him on TV. I've never met him, but he'd be someone you could take DC project bills to directly. You could take our bills, like our Second Amendment tax credit on guns and ammo bill, are taking silencers, suppressors off the national registry so people don't have to go deaf when they're saving their life. He's someone you can really talk to about that. So I would pursue that contact and see if he's willing to introduce some bills, both Action Radio and DC Project bills, because he may want to do that. That might be just a huge contact for you, especially if his wife knows him in DC Project. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that would be a really good one, yeah.
Yeah, I pursue that. Well, let's get him on the show. Let's see if he'll come on the show. I'm serious.
Okay.
Yeah. You know me. Maximize the opportunity. Can't help it. Jim. Back to you, Jim. I'll be like a new show. And back to you, Jim. So what's happening? Second Amendment.
No, Greg Stubbe, I can tell you when Greg was in the Florida House and the Florida Senate, he was a huge 2A supporter and one of the handful of representatives and senators that Florida Kerry could consistently rely on to put forth pro-gun, pro-2A bills within the House and Senate. So,
well, do you know him? Have you met with him at all?
I met with him very briefly, not enough to say that I know him.
Okay, so you two need to team up here. We need to get him on the show for an hour between your two reports. I'm serious, because he might just want to do it. I actually know one of his staff people. She's on my press release list. And so I could contact her myself. And so this might be, he'd be a perfect person to come on, especially since Matt Gaetz has kind of abandoned us here for now, until we get, 5 million listeners, and I guarantee he'll be right back on. But Greg Stubbe is a decent guy. And like I say, everything I've seen about him and heard, he'd be the perfect person to introduce some, really incredible legislation too, from Florida Kerry, from DC Project, and here, our own Action Radio gun bills. So let me talk off the air a little bit, see what we can do about this, I think.
Greg has an interesting background. He actually, after he graduated from University of Florida, he went to law school. And once he graduated from law school, he actually was in the Army for 4 years as a JAG officer and deployed over to Iraq as a JAG officer in the Army. So,
do JAG officers do what do the lawyers do in Iraq? Because it's combat. I had the impression they were mostly back here stateside. I'm curious what kind of work you would have done there.
So a lot of the work, and I've only seen some of what the JAG officers do over there, because when I was there, I wasn't in a place like Baghdad where you'd find most of them. But Governor DeSantis was in Afghanistan as a JAG officer with the Navy supporting the SEALs. So they do a lot of things like they will help with writing and helping the soldiers and the staff interpret what the rules of engagement are when they're over there. So things that can and cannot be done while you're over there. They will assist with the status of forces agreement. So what happens, and that's basically what happens to a U.S. service member if for some reason they commit a crime in the country where they are.
I was thinking about that. They get accused of like killing a civilian or something, or some like horrendous thing like that. Is that where they come in?
It could be that. It could be, something as simple as stealing something from a merchant. This status of forces agreement delineates at what point a crime is something that a U.S. service member can be prosecuted in the host country versus at what point they cannot be, and they can only be subject to U.S. military justice.
Okay. Interesting.
And so they kind of negotiate that and work that through. They oversee things like when there's procurement, buying things from local merchants and making sure that the U.S. military is complying with both U.S. law and the local laws in the country we're doing it. So there's a lot of things.
Oh, sorry, no conflict there between U.S. law and Iraqi law. I bet they're really compatible.
Well, the place you'll sometimes run into issues there is when the U.S. needs to purchase something that might be considered quasi-military, and whether A, the Iraqi law allows another country to purchase that, and B, whether U.S. law allows our military to purchase it from a country like Iraq. So those are the kinds of things you have to look at.
Okay. Pianchi?
Yeah, you have to respect the house that you're in.
Yeah, you do, and that was a huge part of being over there was being able to demonstrate to, whether you were in Iraq or Afghanistan, the locals that you do respect their country, you respect their laws, you respect their traditions. When I was there once a week, I actually sat down against the guidance of some of my leadership. I sat down with our local Iraqi workers and ate lunch with them. They typically brought in lunch for the group of workers that we had, and each
day.
Oh,
what did you dine on? What do Iraqis have for lunch?
I couldn't even tell you what some of it was that I ate. Most of it was very good, but I didn't know what a lot of it was.
Was that safer, you think?
Was it what? I'm sorry.
Safer for you not to know what it was. I'm having
maybe,
fun with
that. I don't think so. You know, the big concern that they had was that, you know, I would get dysentery or something from.
Yeah, I was just thinking parasites. Ivermectin. Yeah. Did you take ivermectin? You don't have to tell me. That's a medical question. But that gets rid of parasites.
Yeah.
And COVID.
There actually was something that the physician's assistant gave me to take that he said would be stronger than an over-the-counter that would help out if there was anything there. But, I mean, for the most part, everything that they brought in, they made a little fire and cooked there.
Okay. Right.
So I know that it had been cooked and heated, and, you know, I brought my own water, so I drank my own water. But, you know, the fact that I once a week sat down and ate lunch with them and, you know, would oftentimes have the interpreter with me so that we could talk back and forth and talk about what was going on in their homes and in their villages, because most of them came in from a village away from the FOB where I was working, I think went a long way to kind of developing a rapport with them that was very helpful later on.
Well, I know this is a little off topic, but I'm curious, since we're here now, how did both you and your fellow soldiers feel, and how did the Iraqis feel about us being there?
So for the most part, I don't know that I met a soldier who was against us being there.
Okay.
Now, I was there fairly early in Iraq, so I don't know if that changed. And
because you're old.
Right, because I'm old, and I'll own that. and also, I didn't have a whole lot of soldiers who I came in direct contact with, so
okay.
I was on a very austere base and very seldom made it back into Baghdad or any of the larger
Fallujah, for example, or some of those.
I was kind of just out in the middle of nowhere. But most of them, and in fact, all of the ones I met, were all in about why we were in Iraq. The Iraqis, the same thing, although, you know, I don't know how much of that was because, you know, I was a military officer that was there and that's what they felt like they had to say.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know,
I'm curious.
They seemed sincere. They seemed sincere. Yeah. They all were very happy that we were there. But again, you know, we're paying them to be there working for the military. Some of that could have just been for my benefit.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what I'm curious. I mean, perceptions are everything. Me personally, I mean, since World War II, we haven't had a declared war. So I love the military, but I don't like the way the military has been used. And if you ever want to talk about that sometime, because you're there, so I don't want to, you know, tread on stuff that you may not want to chat about. But if you do, let me know, because I have some pretty strong opinions on where we should and shouldn't be. Anyway, let's get back to our stuff here, unless anybody else has a question. Shirley's still here, too, and Pianki's here. But any bad news you want to lay on me now that we're here?
No, I don't know that there's always little bad news stories you can tell here and there. One of the other things that I did want to make sure that I shared was that, and I will give full disclosure as I talk about this, the person who made this request, Lee Williams, he is I don't know if he's a staff writer. I don't know what his official title is, but he works for the Second Amendment Foundation as one of their lead authors. But he's the gun writer.
Okay.
Yeah, and he is also on the board of directors of Florida Carry. So, whenever I'm going to tell a story where there might be an apparent conflict of interest or a bias, I want to go ahead and put out there to everyone. I know Lee. I'm friends with Lee. We're on the board of directors of Florida Carry together.
And when's he coming on the show?
Transparency there.
When's he coming on?
Actually, I've talked to him about coming on. He is kept so busy with the Second Amendment Foundation that getting him on during work hours is almost impossible. He is extremely busy in what he is doing. But he actually sent a Freedom of Information Act request to the Biden White House, requesting copies of all documents, both digital and print, that show any interactions between White House staff and members of any gun control or gun safety group.
Interesting.
So that's going to be fun to see what the response is back from the White House on that.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because I was just talking to Amber Kemper, our Constitution reporter, earlier. She's in college now. And I asked her if it would be worth looking into whether her college or any college, you know, has some kind of arrangement or is being spied upon or looked at by the FBI, just like Facebook, who's handing over all the messages. Are there colleges that are handing over, you know, student records to the FBI in the same way? That might be something to look into as well. And the gun groups especially. Or how about us? You know, I mean, I'm still convinced the FBI, KGB, somebody is listening to some parts of our show. I mean, but guys, just call us. You know, we'll have coffee. You know, if you want to come meet, it's all right. You know, I'm here.
Yeah,
you want to know what
absolutely.
I think? Listen to the show. We're pretty open here about what we think. So, you know.
And then I'll give you another good news story, because usually I don't give good news stories to you, Greg. Usually I try to get your blood pressure up on Fridays. And
oh, you succeed mightily, too. So you're.
I know. I'm coming to the conclusion that for your health and for the continuation of the show, at least one Friday a month, I need to make it happy news for Greg and keep your blood pressure down and let you make it through 1 week without me.
Well, thank you.
Really,
well, you're off 1 week too. So this is the 1 week I can do fluff stuff, you know, and not have to engage in a raging debate with you. But I actually enjoy our raging debates.
Another good news story for you then.
Okay.
This one comes out of Texas from a federal judge in Texas who has ruled that someone who has been accused of but not yet convicted of a felony does not relinquish his or her Second Amendment rights.
Well, good.
So they had a man who had been charged with a felony, and I don't even know what felony it was. Oh, it was for burglary. He'd been charged with burglary but had not been to trial yet. And obtained a handgun while he was under indictment and was charged with that in addition to his burglary charge in Texas.
Did he purchase the gun legally?
I would assume so, because he was not charged with purchasing it illegally in any manner other than the fact that he was under indictment for a felony. That was the only charge that he was charged with.
That's a great question. Is that a prohibition? And like I say, Pianchi, Shirley, if you want to jump in here at any time too, is that a prohibition? I mean, you're still, you know, it's like you can't have your assets confiscated. You can't lose your house, your car, like you would after a conviction, which makes sense. I mean, they used to seize things before conviction, and then you had to prove you didn't do it to get your stuff back. But in the same way, why can't you buy a gun when you're under an indictment? You haven't been convicted. You haven't been to trial yet. You still have all your full rights.
And that was the basis of the decision that this federal judge made, is that he said that if you look at the history of gun laws in the United States, there is a long tradition of convicted felons not being allowed to purchase and possess firearms, but there is nothing that he could find which would justify prohibiting someone who had been accused of but not yet convicted of a felony from being able to own and possess firearms, and that it went afoul of the basic principle of one being innocent until proven guilty.
See, that's a better argument. The fact that they had to try and find precedent kind of, you know, there's the blood pressure right there, because you should simply know that innocent until proven guilty means that you cannot restrict somebody until they've been convicted, because they're still under their due process. It's like an ongoing investigation that's going. I think
right. He had to use that analysis because he wants his decision to survive an appeal. And
okay.
with the Supreme Court ruling in Bruin, that was the yardstick that courts are required to use to determine whether an anti-gun law is constitutional or not. So he put the wording in there to ensure that it would survive appeal.
That's like that thing, Pianca, I'll get you in a second. That's that bogus thing I heard Mark Meckler in an interview years ago, and I replayed it recently, said that the Constitution isn't the Constitution. The Constitution is what we know as the Constitution, plus 2,000 pages of court opinion. I'm like, that's bogus. That's BS. Every one of those opinions is subordinate to the Constitution. So the idea that somehow court opinions are equal or even superior, you know, to the Constitution is to me insane. It's irrational. And so this whole idea of precedent, you're trying to find it. So what if there was no precedent, or what if there was a precedent that like red flag laws, for example, there's a precedent for you. And did this court opinion have any effect on red flag laws? Because you would think if you can buy a gun while you're under indictment, then a red flag law that confiscates your firearms before you've done anything will be just as illegal as blocking somebody from buying a firearm while they're under indictment, but they haven't had a conviction yet, I would think. So I hate precedent.
So I would think so as well. And actually, I would contend you hate precedents when the precedents are what you don't agree with.
No, I don't like the whole idea of precedent, because I don't think that's how you make a logical decision. You make a decision on the merit. Oh, yeah, do I like precedents to go my way? Sure. But I wouldn't use them in a court case. I don't think that's a good basis for it. And if I'm going to be consistent, which I actually do try to do, then I can't take the precedents I like. I can't say that judicial review is good when the decisions go my way. Judicial review is an unconstitutional procedure, as we've argued before, but I do also realize, and this is why I'm so glad you pointed this out, that the Supreme Court, in order to, and the courts and the judges, in order to enforce the Constitution, not interpret it, but enforce it and use it in cases, absolutely have to be able to rule that laws, decisions, actions are unconstitutional. What they can't do is then make a remedy or make a policy or then make a, you know, something further, because then they're in the realm of legislation. And that's where I draw the line. But no government entity can make up its own power. You can't do that. And so this idea of precedent or opinions are equal to the Constitution, that holds absolutely no water. There's no basis for it whatsoever.
Yeah.
That's what I think.
So the,
yeah.
the issue
so
you run into without precedent, though, Greg, is
uh-huh.
absent requiring courts to follow precedent, mm-hmm. then the Supreme Court can issue whatever rule they want about a particular law and say, okay, this law in New York is unconstitutional. It
mm-hmm.
clearly violates the exact wording of the Second Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
Then the next day, California passes an almost identical law. It goes before a federal judge in California, and that judge can say, oh, no, this one's legal because I think it's constitutional. And I don't have to listen.
But they can do that anyway.
Precedent and anything else.
That's why that court in California is an inferior court. The president is you're innocent until convicted, until proven guilty. That's the president's right there. No matter what circumstances, it could be a whole array of circumstances. But the president is you're innocent until proven guilty.
Well, it's also the Second Amendment. You know, and we see these things screwed around with all the time. You know, they're still free to do it. You look at Kathy Hochul, the governor who took the court case and then said, okay, yep, well, we're definitely going to honor the court case. You can have a gun, but you can't carry it anywhere. You know, she made it possible to use that right. So they screw around with the law all the time.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is precedent, especially bad precedent, but precedent in general, the idea that you're relying on previous court cases, which are, again, subordinate to, you know, the Constitution, that they can interpret the Constitution as opposed to using it, that they can rely more on precedent, that you have to justify something you're doing with something that some other court did. That to me makes no sense. Now, if you want to cite it, I wouldn't stop courts from using precedent. I think it's perfectly fine to use it, but I don't want to rely on it. I don't want to require it. I don't think that to mandate this, that you have to find a precedent, you know, in order to do what you're doing now, because some cases have no precedent whatsoever, like Roe v. Wade. You know,
right, but
so,
well,
so
what did you say
never,
that lady said?
But Greg, you're never
what
required to find
said?
A precedent. You're only required to follow a precedent from one of your higher courts.
Well,
if,
so that's
if there's
that's
never
not
been
a precedent.
What did you say,
then,
lady?
We got two different definitions of
what
precedent.
What did you say
then.
She said? What did you
Who?
Say she said?
Who?
Kathy or Which, somebody? You said she.
Oh, Kathy Hochul,
governor,
the governor of New York. They have a law, I think it's New York City, and Jim knows about this too, where the Supreme Court, Clarence Thomas wrote an opinion that their law saying their may issue carry law was unconstitutional because the government can't give you, you know, doesn't give you permission to exercise constitutional right. So Kathy Hochul, so New York comes along and says, okay, fine, no problem. Yeah, we'll honor that right. We'll have shall issue permits. But then they didn't let anybody carry them anywhere, Times Square, schools, parks, subways, anything public. Yeah.
Yeah, the point is what she said. We will honor that court decision. But, you know, states have a right not to honor it if they think it's unconstitutional. It still goes back to Uno number one, which cannot, I mean, it's etched in stone.
Yeah, but you have a hard time doing that, which gets back to the, you know, how did the Supreme Court enforce their decisions? And, of course, they can't. That's a, you know, it requires people to actually follow.
Well, but follow. How the Yeah, but the precedence lies with the Constitution itself and how it's written and what it said. You know, innocent until proven guilty, shall not infringe. Those are the precedence rights there.
I don't think innocent until proven guilty is actually in the Constitution.
That's what people continue to go back to.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
I don't think it's actually. I don't think it's actually there, Jim. Is it? Is it somewhere that I haven't seen the innocent until proven guilty?
No, that doesn't appear in the Constitution. That follows from court decisions throughout history and going back to English common law.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a good thing to follow. I absolutely agree with it. But just because
I wonder
it
if they would
the
do the same thing with the Bible, the Ten Commandments.
Okay.
Would they dare question God's commandments on thou shalt not kill? Well, you can't kill unless it's Tuesday or something. This president, yeah, you did it on Tuesday. We got to case before that said it's okay to kill on Tuesday. No.
Well, it's actually that's not murder. I mean, it gets misinterpreted all the time. Like killing people, you know, there's hunting, there's all kinds of things. I mean, things are, you know, there's killing all the time. You know, self-defense is a killing. If you kill somebody in self-defense, you've killed them. Have you murdered them? No. It's a difference.
Thou shalt not covet your neighbor's wife.
Oh, yeah. Good luck enforcing that one. I think we're a little off track here. But I want to bring it back. But to Jim, the idea of precedent, yeah, like I say, if the courts want to use it, that's fine. But I think you're talking about it in a different way. So I want to kind of clarify what you were saying before. So to you, precedent is just the decisions of courts? Or how did you use it? I want to make sure I get this clear.
A precedent is when a court renders a decision on a particular how would I even describe it?
Well, actually, no, I remember now. You said that the inferior courts have to honor the precedent, in other words, the opinion. So it's more the opinion, not necessarily the precedent. Precedent, that comes from stare decisis, which means the strength of things decided. And what my argument with that is, you know, that's like saying subtle law. Well, the courts don't make law, and there's nothing settled about it. I mean, every court case is a new experience.
Yeah,
really,
that's different than precedent. Precedent is requiring an inferior court to obey and follow the decision of a superior court.
Yeah, we got to look this up. We got a difference of opinion here on what precedent actually means. I think I would say there's got to be a word for this. The requiring inferior courts to follow superior courts, that makes sense. But I don't think that's precedent. There's something missing here. Two definitions, and I'm just not sure. Precedent. An act or instance that may be used as an example in dealing with subsequent similar instances. Okay. A judicial decision that is binding on other equal or lower courts. There you go. So you're right there. In the same jurisdiction as to its conclusion or on a point of view, on a point of law, and may also be persuasive to courts in other jurisdictions in subsequent cases involving sufficiently similar facts. So this is actually a good definition of it. Okay. So let's say that it is precedent is, you know, binding on equal or lower courts and persuasive in other courts. I'll go with that. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's actually the perfect definition. If I were much more eloquent, that's what I would have said.
Well, if I were much more eloquent, I wouldn't have to look it up. So you were pretty evil in that regard. Okay. All right. Now, Derek's not here today, so we have some time. I don't know how much time you have, Jim. I actually wanted to get to something that I found interesting, the contract with America that Gingrich and Clinton actually agreed to versus this commitment with America. And I describe the difference as the difference between the contract that Gingrich had and the commitment that McCarthy has is the difference between a marriage and a one-night stand. There's no comparison. There is no comparison of these at all, but I'd like to make one just for folks. Did you have more that you want to talk about, or you want to hang out for that discussion, or do you have to go?
No, I will hang out for a few minutes. I'm going to have to jump off here before too long, but I will be interesting to hear what you have to say. So definitely
will
listen.
Okay. Well, let's get your contact information, Florida Carry, that kind of stuff, and then I shall dive into the commitment to America.
Okay, great. Thanks. So Jim Deitz with the Second Amendment Report. I'm a director with Florida Carry. You can find us on the web at floridacarry.org. You can reach me directly at my email, jim@floridacarry.org. And as always, Greg, it's great to be on and talk with you.
Yeah, even when you raise my blood pressure. That's okay. I can always go bike riding. So I got my exercise. I was in the gym yesterday. Yes! Getting healthier. All right. So just to get folks up to speed on what's happening here, the Republican, what I call the gelding old party, the GOP, absolutely useless as far as I'm concerned. It's not the party of Gingrich. It's not the party of commitment. They're absolute weenies when it comes to dealing with this country now. And as Jim and I have argued, that there are 48 Democrat senators, 50 Republicans, and the Republicans never had the balls to change the rules so that those who caucus with the Democrats aren't counted as Democrats. So that's where we are now. They've let an illegal president sit in the White House. They've let they haven't gone to the border to do anything to stop it or issue cards that say, don't get too comfortable, you aren't staying. You know, there's no daily press conference about election fraud. There's just a million things that they haven't done. They're a bunch of absolutely useless weenies, and they don't deserve to be called the Republican Party. But they have come up with this thing called the Commitment to America. And so I'm going to go through it real quickly here because this is what they're running on. And then I'll get to the contract with America, and you'll be able to see the differences very clearly. So here's their thing. They talk about an economy that's strong. So their goals are, and this isn't a contract. This is just to me, it's like talking points. This is fight inflation and lower the cost of living. Curb wasteful government spending that is raising the price of groceries, gas, cars, and housing, and growing our national debt. And the second one, increase take-home pay, create good-paying jobs, and bring stability to the economy through pro-growth tax and deregulatory policies. Does that mean anything to anybody, or is that a bunch of fluff? I think it's a bunch of fluff. Comments, gentlemen?
No, I agree with you. There's nothing concrete in there. There's no guideline of what they're actually going to do. It's basically their let's get reelected talking points with nothing behind it.
Yeah, the one night stand. I'll say anything to you know, get the hot babe into bed, and then after that we don't care. You know, that's what this struck me as opposed to, and I'll get to the contract that Gingrich had. This is like a long-term commitment. I mean, they were serious in those days, but this is not the same thing. What do you mean curb wasteful government spending? How about curbing government spending? You know, and where is it their job to regulate the price of groceries, gas, cars, and housing? What do you mean? And growing our national debt? How about eliminating our national debt? So the commitment is weak at best. Increase take-home pay? That's not their job unless they're just going to cut taxes. Create good-paying jobs? That's definitely not their job. Their job is to get out of the way. And how are they going to bring stability to the economy? Okay, so none of this stuff makes any sense. They can't do it, and they shouldn't do it, and they don't have legislation to do it anyway. Next section, make America energy independent and reduce gas prices. Oh, well, that's a good idea. Maximize production of reliable, cleaner, American-made energy and cut the permitting process time in half to reduce reliance on foreign countries, preventing rolling blackouts, and lower the cost of gas and utilities. They can't do that. You know, states do utilities. Foreign countries do their own thing. And what do you mean permitting time in half? How long is it now? And how exactly are you going to do that? This is like feel-good fluff. You know, same thing.
So
what do you think?
Just a quick question, since you said that, you know, this is something that they can't do, only states can do. It was this Republican statement,
yes,
or a Republican U.S. Congress is going to, because if it's a Republican statement, then there are Republicans in all of the states. So if it's an overarching policy for the GOP, then I would think it would apply to states as well and state GOP elected representatives.
Well, I'm assuming the GOP is in on this at the federal level. At state level, I honestly don't know. I don't know what they're going to do.
I just wasn't
they're gonna coordinate.
Sure.
Yeah, but if they can coordinate with the state things, now they could cut the permitting time in half. But to me, that's like saying this when Trump said, I'm going to cut, you know, two regulations for every one that passes. It's meaningless. That's the wrong thing. Why not cut permitting time, you know, to like 1/8? I mean, this, you know, they're too nebulous in this thing. And how does this permitting process work? This is, you know, I'd like to see legislation. We have, if they said we have legislation to drastically cut the permitting time, that would make more sense. But they're just talking about it in terms of goals. And how are they going to stop rolling blackouts? Where are you going to stop that? California? What's California going to say? Sorry, we don't have the power. You know, give us more money. And lowering the cost of gas and utilities, Trump already did that. And he did it through supply. Here's another one. Strengthening the supply chain and end dependence on China. Move supply chains away from China, expand U.S. manufacturing, and enhance America's economic competitiveness and cyber resiliency. Can someone translate that for me? Yeah. Thought so. I'm stating these things here. Maybe I should just go through them. You may not have an answer for each one. Here's another one. A nation that's safe. Secure the border and combat illegal immigration. Yeah, like they've ever done that. Fully fund effective border enforcement strategies, infrastructure, and advanced technology to prevent illegal crossings and trafficking by cartels. Where's the wall? Okay. End catch and release loopholes. Not end catch and release. End catch and release loopholes. Require legal status to get a job. We already have that with E-Verify. And what is legal status? And eliminate welfare incentives. Well, I'd like to eliminate welfare. In other words, they're saying the right things, but there's no proposals. There's no law. There's nothing here to latch onto. Comments on that, or should I continue on? Hearing none, I'll continue on. Reduce crime and protect public safety. Support 200,000 more police officers through recruiting bonuses and oppose all efforts to defund the police. Again, police are a local and state matter, and where do they pick 200,000 from? Another one, crack down on prosecutors and district attorneys who refuse to prosecute crimes while permanently criminalizing all forms of illicit fentanyl. District attorneys are elected. How exactly are they going to do that? Now, the governors can fire them, as far as I know. I think DeSantis fired that guy. Well, Jim, you know about that. This guy in Tampa? The one that openly said he was going to defy laws and do what he felt like? Wasn't he fired?
What did this turn
Jim's
in
gone.
Illinois?
Whoop, Jim left. I'm sorry. Yeah, Jim left. I didn't realize that. So my mistake. I should have noticed that. So, yeah, cash bail. My point here with this is that they're talking a good game, but they're not actually doing anything. Let me give you another one here. There's a few more of these. Oh, here's one. Defend national security. Support our troops. Invest in an efficient, effective military. Establish a select committee on China. What the hell does that mean? And exercise peace through strength with our allies to counter increasing global threats. They're not saying anything. Bianchi, they're not saying anything.
Well, you know what the problem is, Greg.
What's that?
And we always go back to this. He's talking to... Oh, she is talking to ignorant people.
Okay. Yeah.
How
well,
do
this is,
you know,
this is Kevin
how
McCarthy.
Do an ignorant person, how do an ignorant person not know that what he is hearing can't be done?
Yeah.
From who he's hearing it from.
Yeah, exactly. This is Kevin McCarthy. I think these are just election talking points. Make sure every child, every student can succeed and give parents a voice. You know, it says advance the Parents' Bill of Rights. Well, they actually, down the state, this is the first thing they've actually stated. Recover lost learning from school closures. I don't know how you do that. Expand parental choice so over a million more students can receive the education their parents know is best. Well, how about full school choice? So they're tinkering. Defend fairness. Well, that's interesting. By ensuring that only women can compete in women's sports. You know, and this is achieving longer, healthier lives for Americans. I actually put this in this commitment. Personalized care to provide affordable options and better quality delivered by trusted doctors. How does the government do that? You know, lower prices.
Yeah, and now I agree with some of the things he's saying, but
yeah,
he's reminding people about something that they should already be doing, know of, like school choice. Yes, I think the money should follow the child based on the parents' suggestion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, full vouchers, but he didn't say full vouchers. Here's another one. Lower prices through transparency, choice, and competition. Invest in life-saving cures. we skip the non-life-saving cures. All right. And improve access
but
to telemedicine.
Even so,
yeah.
He doesn't have, federal government doesn't have any power to implement those. Even
exactly.
The school choice, that's state. Yes. Yeah.
Do you know what's interesting about all these things, too? Every one of these costs money. Here's another one. Confront big tech and demand fairness. That's not going to get anywhere. Provide greater privacy and data security protections. Equip parents with more tools to keep their kids safe online. Well, parents can keep their kids safe online, too. They can turn it off. You don't have to, there's no regulation for this, right? And stop companies from putting politics ahead of people. What the hell does that mean? Yeah. Here's another one. A government that's accountable. Preserve our constitutional freedoms. One would think that would be their primary duty since they swear an oath to do just that. It says uphold free speech, protect the lives of unborn children and mothers, guarantee religious freedom, and safeguard the Second Amendment. Well, isn't that what the First and the Second Amendment do now? This is their commitment? So the commitment is to honor their oath? Here's another one. Hold Washington accountable. Conduct rigorous oversight to rein in government abuse of power and corruption. Provide real transparency and require the White House to answer for its incompetence at home and abroad. How about getting them out of office for election fraud, treason, and a coup and everything else? I mean, there's like nothing bold here. This is the weakest, wimpiest thing I think I've ever heard. Let me just give you the last one. Restore the people's voice. End special treatment for members of Congress by repealing proxy voting and increase accountability in the election process through voter ID, accurate voter rolls, and observer access. Well, how are they going to do that? They can't do any of this. They can't do most of this. And the part they can do costs money.
Well, ensure voter ID can be done with federal ballots, but you know where we are on that one.
Oh, yeah. Let me give you the real one here. Let me give you the contract with America. So this is Newt Gingrich. This is September 27th, 1994. It says the contract. Let me get the website is. I don't see what the website is. Oh, I guess the website is Contract with America. There we go. It says the contract with America was the conservative action of more than 300 Republican congressional candidates who signed it. Led by the Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, the contract was presented at a September 27, 1994 press conference. The following is a proposal as well as the actual contract that was presented by Republican members of the House of Representatives. The contract with America is rooted in three core principles, accountability, responsibility, and opportunity. And so I'll skip that. I want to go just in the interest of time. I want to go right to the actual contract itself. It says on the first day of the 104th Congress, the new Republican majority will immediately pass the following major reforms aimed at restoring the faith and trust of the American people in their government. First, require all laws that apply to the rest of the country also apply equally to the Congress. Second, select a major independent auditing firm to conduct a comprehensive audit of Congress for waste, fraud, or abuse. Third, cut the number of House committees and cut committee staff by one-third. Fourth, limit the terms of all committee chairs. Fifth, ban the casting of proxy votes in committee. Sixth, require committee meetings to be open to the public. Seven, require a three-fifths majority vote to pass a tax increase. Eight, guarantee an honest accounting of our federal budget by implementing zero baseline budgeting. Thereafter, within the first 100 days of the 104th Congress, we shall bring to the House floor for public inspection and security, and we'll get to these other ones in a minute. But look at those eight principles. Now compare that to the commitment that you just heard, 5 minutes ago. You see the difference? Unmute.
Yeah, it is a difference.
I mean, to me, it's night and day. This is a comprehensive proposal. They're spelling exactly which bills are going to bring when. Here are the ones they want to do. So it says here, within 100 days, here are the bills they're going to present. The Fiscal Responsibility Act, a balanced budget tax limitation amendment, and a legislative line item veto to restore fiscal responsibility to an out-of-control Congress, requiring them to live under the same budget constraints as families and businesses. That's the first bill. The Taking Back Our Streets Act, an anti-crime package including stronger truth in sentencing, good faith exclusionary rule exemptions, effective death penalty provisions, and cuts in social spending from this summer's crime bill to fund prison construction and additional law enforcement to keep people secure in their neighborhoods and kids safer in their schools. That's totally different than what the commitment that McCarthy's talking about. This is a real proposal. Stop me when you want. I'll continue on here. And we got another guest at 10 o'clock. We're going to talk climate change. 3, the Personal Responsibility Act. Discourage illegitimacy and teen pregnancy by prohibiting welfare to minor mothers and denying increased AFDC, that's aid to families with dependent children, for additional children while on welfare. Cut spending for welfare programs and enact a tough 2 years and out provision with work requirements to promote individual responsibility. This stuff is brilliant. We could use this now. This is a great contract. Here's another one. The Family Reinforcement Act, child support enforcement, tax incentives for adoption, strengthening rights of parents in their children's education, stronger child pornography laws, and an elderly dependent care tax credit to reinforce the central role of families in American society. 5, the American Dream Restoration Act, a $500 per child tax credit, begin repeal of the marriage tax penalty, and creation of the American Dream Savings Account to provide middle-class tax relief. 6, the National Security Restoration Act. No U.S. troops under U.N. command and restoration of the essential parts of our national security funding to strengthen our national defense and maintain our credibility around the world. 7, I think there's 10 of these. Okay, so we're almost done. The Senior Citizens Fairness Act. Raise the Social Security earnings limit, which currently forces seniors out of the workforce, repeal the 1993 tax hikes on Social Security benefits, and provide tax incentives for private long-term care insurance to let older Americans keep more of what they have earned over the years. 8, the job creation.
Good.
Yeah, all these are good. I can go back to any one of them. All these are good. 8, the Job Creation and Wage Enforcement Act. Small business incentives, capital gains cuts, and indexation, neutral cost recovery, risk assessment cost benefit analysis, strengthening the Regulatory Flexibility Act, and unfunded mandate reform to create jobs and raise worker wages. 9, the Common Sense Legal Reform Act. Loser pays laws, okay? Reasonable limits on punitive damages and reform of product liability laws to stem the endless tide of litigation. And 10, the Citizen Legislature Act. Well, this got my attention right away. You know, it's the Citizen Legislature, right? This is a first ever vote on term limits to replace career politicians with citizen legislators. Further, we will instruct the House Budget Committee to report to the floor, and we will work to enact additional budget savings beyond the budget cuts specifically included in the legislation described above to ensure that the federal budget deficit will be less than it would have been without the enactment of these bills. So there we go. Yep. But this is the Citizen Legislature Act, a first ever vote on term limits to replace career politicians with citizen legislators. That's where term limits came from. Came from the contract with America. So there you go. Fiscal responsibility, taking back our streets. Personal responsibility. We've got family reinforcement, American Dream Act, National Security Restoration. We've got fairness. We've got senior citizens fairness, job creation and wage enhancement, common sense legal reform, and citizen legislators. That's a damn good contract. See, Pianca wants to unmute and talk about that. Well, I got covered what I wanted. I got through both of them. But the difference, the differences between these two contracts is so clear, so absolutely blatantly obvious. You know, go back to some of these other ones here. Fight inflation and lower the cost of living. Curb wasteful government spending that is raising the price of groceries, gas cars. What's that?
Oh, somebody was hollering at me. I had to holler back, but I'm sorry.
Yeah, but you're on the air when you did it.
I was just getting ready to reply to you, but
Yeah, okay. Anyway, but the difference between these two is so drastic, so dramatic, so stark in terms of actual legislation versus, you know, talking points. I mean, I'm embarrassed for them, and I don't think they're embarrassed at all, but they should be. What do you think?
Well, I would like to see a lot of those things put in place. Matter of fact, there should be some campaign war cries. But once again, you know, people have to ask for those things to mm-hmm. be put in place, and you just don't have that sort of participation as we should.
Well, I see too much wiggle room, because with this commitment to America, they're basically talking points. There's no legislative commitment. There's no acts. you know, you look at the 10 points of the contract with America that Gingrich had, each one was an act. There was actually legislation. It was a bill they were actually going to file in the first 100 days. These were real proposals. They weren't just, you know, aspirations. They weren't just talking points. They weren't just, here's a, you know, wish list of what we'd like to do maybe. See, I have no faith in the Republican Party at this point. This is why I brought this out. There's no reason to believe that I can see that these people are actually going to do anything that they said they're going to do once they're elected. Again, it's the one night stand versus the marriage. You know, Newt Gingrich had a real contract. He said, we're making a commitment to you. This is what we propose. This is what we pledge. This is what we're going to do. These are the bills. We're going to honor our pledge. We're going to honor our contract. And here it is. As opposed to McCarthy, you know, well, we might do this. You know, here's what we're thinking of. We're going to make a commitment, you know, for today. It's just, anyway, I think it's a very clear, very, very clear contrast between the two. So let me get a comment from you. I'll play a couple things, and we'll get to Mike Clinch, who's going to come back. He was an earth science teacher in school. We're going to talk climate change. So he'll be here in a little bit.
Is Derek coming? Oh, that's right. He's going to be gone for a couple weeks.
Derek's
right?
Off today. Well, I don't know how many. I know he's off today. So we'll find out. It was sort of week by week at this point. But, yeah, that's what's going on. All right, let me play a couple things, and I'll be back in a little bit.
From addiction to achievement, that is the story of Mike Lindell. It started with MyPillow and now goes to MyCoffee. Action Radio is proud to be an affiliate of MyPillow. Our discount code is the same for all our product affiliates, WYL, which stands for Write Your Laws. MyPillow pillows are guaranteed the most comfortable pillow you'll ever own. Action Radio is guaranteed to be the most controversial show you will ever hear. Check out their products with our discount code at mypillow.com/WYL. That's mypillow.com/WYL. Or order now by calling 1-800-544-8939. That's 1-800-544-8939. Sleep well, so you can wake up and hear Action Radio live.
Greg Penglis here for my book, The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction. Everyone at some point in their life wants to learn how to fly. Few try. Even fewer go on to get a license. I believe a major reason for that is how we teach people how to fly. My book is designed to help you navigate the flight training system, but it's so much more than that. It really describes an entirely new way to teach flying. So if you've never tried a lesson or got discouraged in your training and quit for any reason, this book can help you. Don't be a rote pilot who just follows procedures. Be a thinking pilot who makes great decisions, who understands all the reasons why we do what we do. You can incorporate these principles into your own flight training at any time. The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction is featured on the Action Radio with Greg Penglis Facebook page and is available from Amazon.com.
Do you know your way around healthcare, insurance, pharmacies, surgery, alternative treatments and choices? I don't. Which is why I'm so glad I met Priscilla Romans, had her on Action Radio, and learned about health patient advocacy. She is the founder of Great Care. And now as an affiliate of Great Care, we are proud to offer through our discount code, WYL, which stands for Write Your Laws, a 10% discount. Grave Care saves you both time and money. They provide medical advocacy, consultation, advice, and recommendations nationwide. Their website is gravecare.com. That's G-R-A-I-T-H-care.com. You can email them at gravecare.adm@gmail.com or call them at 469-864-7149. That's 469-864-7149. Great Care, better health through better knowledge and advocacy.
This is Greg Penglis for Strikeforce, your source for pure energy. Strikeforce is a concentrated energy drink that turns a half liter of your favorite beverage into an energy drink. You make your energy drink yourself. Action Radio is an affiliate of Strikeforce, so our listeners get a 20% discount. All you do is add our code, WYL, to the discount code window at checkout. WYL comes from our website, Write Your Laws. So, you can get your energy drink, a 20% discount, and help Action Radio change the relationship of we the people to our government. Not bad. Strikeforce is at StrikeforceEnergy.com. That's StrikeForceEnergy.com. Start your engines. Action Radio. Part of the ADHD Radio Network. The ultimate free speech zone. We the people give our consent to be governed through writing the laws by which we are governed and have the power through juries to nullify the laws by which we do not consent to be governed. At Action Radio, we don't report the news. We are the news. Every other show reports what has happened. We talk about what can happen. From the questions no one has thought to ask, to the answers no one has thought to consider, to the actions no one has dared to take. That is Action Radio. We are back. So, Mike's been on the show before. He was running for, I think, county commission. We'll find out if I've totally botched that up. But Mike Lynch and Pianchi's back on the line, too. And Mike was – we got to chatting about climate change a little bit, and Mike was a earth science teacher for years and years. So I thought, well, let's come back on and talk about climate change. Let's talk about the – or as I'm calling it, political climate change. So the political climate might be changing, but the climate's doing just fine. But these people are trying to convince us that if we don't, you know, drive electric cars and – eliminate carbon dioxide, we're all going to die. Well, just the opposite is true. We don't need the electric cars, and we do need the carbon dioxide. So they've got it backwards. So I thought I'd have Mike come back and tell us about it and see what's going on. So, Mike, welcome back. How you doing?
Thank you, Mr. Pinglis. How are you?
Fine. Call me Greg, please.
Oh, okay.
The dude behind the microphone. So let's get your background. What do you know? How did you get into earth science? What is earth science in schools? What were you teaching? What are they teaching now? Let's go background on the science, the earth science educational thing.
Background? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I came by it, honestly. I mean, I'm from a family of teachers. Mm-hmm. I'm a third generation teacher. I actually took a geology class in college because I wanted to get 5 credit hours. I didn't take it necessarily. But, you know, what got me interested was when I saw the bodies in Pompeii. And when I saw, you know, they poured the plaster into the volcanic ash and they found the people, you know, the expressions on their faces and everything else. And I was sitting in a class watching this at college and I was like, I can do this. So kind of a morbid way to get involved in it, but I just started there and never looked back. So I graduated from Southeast Missouri State in Missouri, of course, and then started teaching and did that for 25 years. So, and kind of an interesting sidelight, my sister is a retired lieutenant colonel, Air Force, and she flew 17 years with the Hurricane Hunters. So we kind of have our head in the clouds, our family, if you don't mind the expression, but
no, I don't mind. I want to get her on the show, too, though. I'm kind of curious to talk to somebody that flew intentionally into hurricanes. That's interesting to me.
Oh, and she did a lot of research. She did a lot of research for NOAA. They collect a lot of data. And,
what do they do with it?
You know, I have to give it. You're right. Well, they give it to NOAA, and then who knows where it goes. Yeah. But, you know, she had some very interesting observations over the years, and I have, too, and it just – it's become very, very so politicized, and people don't understand. I think they've ignored the history of the Earth, the history of the atmosphere. Things have happened that we've had no control over. And it's like the climate catastrophists ignore the fact that we're only one volcanic eruption away from a worldwide famine. We're only one, let's be honest, asteroid strike away from who knows what. So this idea that man is going to destroy himself, I have, with the environment at least, I have more of a concern about what the Earth is going to do. You know, it doesn't take much for us to get slapped down by any of those kind of events. So that's why I think it's important to understand what nature has to do with it. And they're ignoring it in the news. They ignore the history. They don't talk about what's happened with volcanic eruptions and twice in past history. One we know about, Mount Pinatubo in 1991. And then prior to that was the one a lot of people don't know about was Mount Tambora in 1815, which created the year without a summer. It actually
it was
snowed in Albany, New York.
Wasn't it Krakatoa that did that?
No.
Oh, okay.
Krakatoa was only half the size of Mount Tambora.
Where's Tambora?
Krakatoa lower. Yeah, Tambora is in Indonesia,
okay,
which in the same vicinity as Krakatoa.
Mm-hmm.
Mount Pinatubo was in the Philippines. And the reason I refer to Mount Pinatubo is because anybody that was in the military in the 90s knows that Clark Air Force Base was a big in and out point, dropping off and taking out point for Asia. And
mm-hmm.
Mount Pinatubo destroyed Clark Air Force Base. They basically got everybody out of there just in time before it collapsed all the hangars and everything else with the volcanic ash.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that lord, here's the interesting thing. Let's talk temperature real quick.
Mm-hmm.
Mount Tambora lowered worldwide temperature by 1.43 degrees. Now,
which is huge.
Granted, yes, it's huge.
Yeah.
That was called the year without a summer. There were famines in Ireland. There were there was snow
wait,
in
what
Albany,
year was that
New
again?
York in June.
Is that one of the potato famines? So what year would that have been? What was it again?
I have read some accounts where people have tried to – the development of that fungus that was killing the potatoes and everything, spoiling them, that
right.
It could have had origins back to 1815.
Okay.
To the actual – because it was cold that entire summer.
Yeah.
And like I said, it snowed in Albany, New York in June. And one location in England had, I believe, 12 inches of snow in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't understand. That had nothing to do with our cars shutting off automatically at stoplights and anything. It had nothing to do with that. And Mount Pinatubo, that's another thing I'm going
to
talk about. And Mount Pinatubo.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, and Mount Pinatubo was actually only one-third the size of Mount Tambora. The worldwide temperature was, I think, 0.4 degrees lower that summer of 91.
So explain why the temperature lowers. Explain to folks why the temperature lowers with a volcano.
Volcanoes emit various gases and debris and so on. One of the biggest ones they emit is sulfur dioxide. Well, what happens is sulfur dioxide gets aerosolized. In other words, when a volcano goes off, it's kind of like an aerosol can. You push the button and it explodes out, basically, the difference in pressure. The same thing happens with a volcano. The volcano, though, has a lot of constituents like ash, sulfur, carbon dioxide, and so on. That sulfur dioxide mixes with water in the air and aerosolizes, and it becomes an insulator. It absorbs incoming solar radiation, what we call insolation. It actually absorbs that in the upper layers of the atmosphere, stratosphere and on up. And it lowers
the amount of radiation. So how high is that for folks? So we're talking like 35, 50,000 feet, 75,000? Yeah.
10, I usually use miles because that's usually easier. Usually above 6 miles, the troposphere, depending on where you are on the Earth, goes up about 6 miles. Above that is the stratosphere. And that's where you start seeing this is in the stratosphere. That's where that gets absorbed. So as a result, worldwide temperatures go down almost instantly. It's almost like taking a light switch and flipping it off.
Solar radiation comes in, right? So the sun radiates,
correct.
You know, so the fusion reaction. So that radiation has to hit our atmosphere. Now, if there's more absorbing stuff in the atmosphere, then less radiation is going to get to Earth. Is that how it works, right?
Correct.
Because the Earth warms the atmosphere, as I understand it. The sun hits the Earth. Whatever radiation gets to the Earth warms the Earth, and the Earth, in turn, warms the air above it. And because the top of the atmosphere is further away from the Earth, it's a lot cooler than the air immediately at Earth where it's at its hottest. Right?
Mm-hmm. Depending on where you are. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it's average. The average size of the first layer, the troposphere, is about 6 miles.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're flying on, say, in a regular flight, let's just say from Pensacola to Baltimore or whatever, you're flying at 31,000, 32,000 feet. You're at the edge of the troposphere, partially in the stratosphere. you're basically right there. So you're actually that high above on average, depending on where you're flying to and so on. So, yeah, I know I flew to Paris this summer. We were at 35,000 feet most of the way. So,
that's normal.
You know, it
just
kind of varies. It depends. So, anyway, aerosolized sulfur dioxide prevents that radiation from coming and it lowers global temperature. Now, in terms of geologic history, it's like turning, like I said, turning a light off in a room. It's like what happened to the dinosaurs. Flip the switch off, gone. Now, what happened, you know, there's still a lot of discussion about, you know, what brought an end to the dinosaurs. But when you look at events in Earth history, mass extinctions have always happened. Now, man wasn't here. It wasn't gas from a tailpipe. What was it? And this whole idea, I think our priorities are kind of skewed the wrong way. We're worried about engines idling at stoplights when we should be considered equally, you know, oh, here comes an asteroid. Gee, you know, as I'm
well,
saying,
see, now, there are people concerned with that. There are people concerned with that, but, you know, but it's not as big a deal as it should be. And they're worrying, like I said, they're worrying about the wrong things. Well, that's why I call it political climate change. We'll get into that. Now, how about the ash from a volcano? Does the ash block out the sun, or is it more this absorbing, you know, H2SO4 is kind of like sulfuric acid? That's what it sounds like.
And actually, while the ash does make a difference, it's more of, it falls out. It's more of a local, well, we can call it local, but in the immediate area of the volcano, you will find more of the ash, but it will go up in the atmosphere. The sulfur dioxide, now you were talking about Krakatoa, the summers where it was orange, the orange sky, that was also due partially to the ash, but again, to the sulfur dioxide. And that's what created the bright sunsets. I think it was 4 or 5 years that it was in the atmosphere. So when you talk about the various effects and what it does, it kind of varies. We've not had, since Mount Pinatubo, we had one explosion in Tonga in the Pacific, but we've not had a major earth-altering event since Mount Pinatubo, and that was only half a degree. So
how,
see how things change.
Yeah, how much are we talking about in terms of compound? I want to try and see if we can equate, you know, total vehicle exhaust to the amount that of stuff Pinatubo would kick out, just to kind of get an order of magnitude. So how much stuff did Pinatubo kick out compared to an average year of all the vehicles in the world? Has there any been a measure of that at all?
It's in the millions of pounds. To use that as an to try and compare it, Mount Pinatubo, I believe, kicked out, I want to say 12 cubic miles of Earth's surface.
Wow.
To give you an idea, Mount St. Helens was just over 1 cubic mile. So if you want to compare what people saw at Mount St. Helens versus Mount Pinatubo, it's our Tambora and any of those. Mount St. Helens was just like a little squirt gun compared to being at the end of a fire hose. That's the kind of amounts of material we're talking about. Ash,
how about the gases too? Everything is, you know, basically pollution. So if you think of a volcano in terms of pollution, how much pollution was kicked out compared to how much? Well, let's do Mount St. Helens to the United States, for example. Have they measured the amount of car exhaust, you know, carbons, carbon dioxides, nitrous oxides, sulfur oxides, things like that? How much pollution do our vehicles produce in a year compared to how much stuff did Mount St. Helens kick out? Is there any relative scale?
I can't
any work
give you
on
an
that?
Exact number.
Okay.
I didn't look that number up. But
okay.
What I can tell you is when you comparatively speaking, you're talking about a large amount in a very, very short, literally minutes, that is erupting out of that fissure or that volcano. And when you talk about that versus, this is where the political part comes in. People who are worried about their cars stopping at stoplights or, you know, idling off and everything else, it's just wrong. The whole priorities we have in this country when it comes to global warming and pollution and everything else, we all want a clean environment. Hey, I vacation in the Ozarks every year of my life, and there's nothing more beautiful. Everybody wants clean air and clean water. The problem is how you get there. this whole idea of Gavin Newsom saying, well, we're going to have all electric cars by 2035. Please, it's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. And this whole idea of like turning the light switch off again, we want to just end carbon pollution just like that. You can't do it. It's a great goal.
Well, why would you want to? Well, first of all, carbon's not pollution. This, we've talked about this before. Carbon's an essential component of life. We went over that. I forgot when we did that fairly recently. Mm-hmm. That if you don't have, maybe you and I did it, but if you don't have carbon, you know, you don't have life. Oh, you know, who's my?
Oh,
it was Judy Mikovits. We had it was last Thursday. It was Judy Mikovits, not yesterday, but the week before, talking about carbon, talking about how it's the building block of life, and that carbon, you know, in part of its carbon cycle, it's carbon dioxide, which means, and it's just interesting that we're producing carbon dioxide by burning what we're calling organic fuels now. We don't call them fossil fuels anymore. There's organic fuels. So we burn our organic fuel, coal, oil, natural gas, and that releases carbon into the atmosphere, which bonds with oxygen to form carbon dioxide, which comes down to the earth as plant food. So actually burning, so it doesn't get much cleaner. In fact, we're actually recycling. We're recycling carbon. We're, you know, so to say that this is not a good idea, you know, to me, these are people who want to kill everybody. Because if you're taking carbon out of the atmosphere, you're taking carbon away from plants, you're taking carbon out of our food cycle, you're basically ending life. How can this possibly be a good idea to limit carbon and carbon dioxide? I don't get it.
And here's a political, here's a kind of a vein on, I've thought about this yesterday because I knew we were going to be talking. I was sitting in a stoplight in Fort Walton Beach, and of course my car shut off again. So I hit that button that allows
you to
keep
going. My car keeps going.
Oh, so yours look like Uncle Buck's car? Maybe that's you're putting.
That's kind of my old man car. When I get the car I want, it's going to be a 1960s car, so it's going to be even bigger engine, you know, more fuel, and I don't give a damn.
I thought it was a Buick Century or something from the 70s. You know, that's what I was envisioning.
Be nice. I want a Riviera. Give me a Riviera with those headlights. See, here's another thing, too. Cars are boring. You know, with all the regulations and all the problems. In fact, I actually wrote a Creative Car Act. You know, I mean, give me a Buick Riviera with those headlight louver thingies that fold up. That was the coolest thing. That was really great. Or the Corvette Stingrays where the headlights popped up. You know, cars are, or fins. Yeah. Man, I want a 1959 Eldorado with the four little tail lights up on the tail because they made them look like airplanes. Okay, cars are boring. You know, people. Go ahead.
No. I was just saying my car is the 1977 Bandit Trans Am.
Oh, there you go. Perfect.
Smokey and the Bandit.
That's a great car. Yeah. Car. So it is a Bandit. You got the big sticker. You got the big eagle on the hood. The whole bit.
Oh, the Phoenix on the hood and
the
waffle.
Oh, excuse me. It's a Phoenix. Yeah. You got the little spoiler on the back. Okay, what's your engine?
Oh yeah, and then the.
Wait a minute. This isn't shut off of traffic lights. This car doesn't shut off of traffic lights.
No.
So is this another car you have, or is this a car, your dream car, or this is a car you actually own?
This is my dream car. I think every man has their dream car. You know, car that you never could own. That you wanted. Mine
you could
is
own
a Bandit
it.
Trans Am.
Why couldn't you own it? Why can't you own a Bandit Trans Am?
I looked them up. They go online. The complete restored models go for between 100 and 100 and a half. It depends. If you get the complete Bandit package, which was actually only a wrap and basically the wheels and stickers. That was basically the Trans Am, the TA Bandit package. But
you
can
get a regular Trans Am and either paint it up, make it a nice scarlet red or something exciting. You don't have to have the Bandit Trans Am. Here's the point, though.
No.
The reason we're talking about this, and listen to our voices, okay? We're excited about this. Now, I don't think it's men, just men. I mean, obviously, it's us guys. I think women like cars, too. But the point is cars are boring. So if you so the left wants your life miserable. You can't have anything. You can't collect anything. You can't value anything that's exciting. You can't, you know, I want to buy a jet and fly upside down over Pensacola Beach. Why not? Who's going to stop me? Well, the left will because it's not necessary.
Blue angels do it all the time. Yeah.
Exactly. But, well, they're government, so it's okay. So they're a government demonstration.
Oh, yeah. That's okay.
But here's the thing. Old cars are exciting. I mean, nobody would pick a 2020, even though it's new, nobody wants a 2022 Lexus over a 1961 Corvette, unless they're idiots.
No.
Right?
I like my 1967 GTO.
See, there you go. So Pianchi's got his favorite. Pianchi's on the line, too.
Yeah.
67 GTO? Okay. I want a 67 Pontiac Firebird. That's my car. Convertible.
Yep. Oh,
so we all have our cars.
Yeah. I was trying to remember. I remember the Firebird because I had a good friend in college who drove a green Firebird. Ugliest green car you ever saw.
Well, the color might be bad. You always hate it. Yeah. But the thing about Firebird, it's not one of the big classics. It's not like the 61 Corvette, so it's not going to cost me $250,000. It's my starter classic. Then we'll work on the Jaguar XKE and the Ferrari 308, the Magnum Ferrari, and a couple of other things I want to own. But the point is that cars are exciting. Cars are part of life. And people that think that cars aren't part of life and excitement isn't part of life, you know, if you're a leftist, you want everybody miserable and dead. I mean, those are the options. Miserable, then dead. That's what they want. So when you take away carbon, you're literally hold on a second. When you take away carbon and carbon dioxide and have all these cars be electric and everything else that you want to do, all these regulations and things, you know, our food supply, nitrogen fertilizer, the whole bit, they're basically stealing our lives. Because part of our life is our excitement, is the fun, is the joy of driving fast in a convertible with the top down with some hot babe beside you with the hair streaming back. That's what life's all about. That's what makes it exciting. And whatever your passion is, that these people want to take it away. They probably think that my electric guitar playing is frivolous because I'm wasting power on playing rock music. Well, screw you. My amp uses a 30-watt amp. It uses less than a light bulb. So get over it, you leftist wackos.
They want you to be like James Taylor and play acoustic guitar on the South Lawn.
I've seen rain. I've seen heroin from 1962. Yeah, exactly. But think about the way they steal our lives. This is a bogus theory.
Mm-hmm.
Carbon dioxide is not killing the planet. Leftists are. Carbon dioxide is good for
us. They want to steal.
It's plant food.
They want to steal.
So how did this ridiculous theory come about? Tell me about the history of what I call political climate change.
Ignorance.
Yeah, but where
ignorance.
Did it show up in school?
Plants put carbon back into the soil.
Exactly.
Through the process of photosynthesis. What about that one method called biochar? Is that good?
What's that? I don't know what that is. Mike?
I don't recall that. I'm sorry.
What's it called, Pianki?
Biochar, C-H-A-R.
Well, char is like
I've heard
burning.
Of that.
Yeah,
char like charcoal.
Huh. Well, charcoal's carbon. Really?
Yep.
It's a form of carbon.
Oh,
wow. So when did this nonsense creep into the schools, Mike? Were you forced to teach it? Did they give it into you in your syllabus? Was it gradual or was it all at once? How did this come about?
It was very gradual. And actually, it was just a blip. It really wasn't. In terms of talking about the entire structure of the atmosphere and everything else, I spent, you know, a whole quarter of the school year just on that so that the kids had a working knowledge so they could do meteorology. And it's like not learning how to drive a car without turning the engine on. That's the analogy I use. So we spent most of the time developing the kids' respect for the atmosphere, what it does, how it, you know, protects us from ultraviolet rays, things like that. But we didn't get into the nitty-gritty carbon dioxide. We talked about the greenhouse effect, how it warms the earth. But we never went into this, oh, it's going to destroy us, it's going to kill us, it's going to, you know. I'd love to see a textbook now because I believe it's
Let's talk about that. What is the greenhouse effect and how does it warm the earth?
Okay. Greenhouse effect, everybody experiences it, especially in the winter. Now, not where we live, but if you're in a cooler climate during the winter, you roll your car windows up, you go inside to work or whatever. You come out, if you open your car door, you notice it's warm inside your car. It might be 30, 40 degrees outside, but your car is pleasant. I mean, it actually feels warm. Well, the windows in your car act like the atmosphere. Radiation comes in as long wave radiation. It comes in as ultraviolet. When it hits the surface of the car, like it hits the surface of the earth, it turns into short wave or infrared radiation, which can't escape back through the glass, in our case, back through the earth's atmosphere. So the same process warming your car, it's basically the same process that warms the earth.
But glass is a solid. Glass is a solid and air is air. Air is a gas. How can it have the same effect?
But because of the wavelength.
Okay.
It won't allow the wavelength back out. So in other words, the short wave radiation, the heat radiation gets trapped. The long wave radiation comes in, makes it through the atmosphere. A lot of it does get absorbed in the upper atmosphere, in the mesosphere, and the ionosphere. But the stuff that does make it down to the earth strikes the Earth's surface, turns to infrared heat energy, and warms the Earth. the same way your car warms in the winter when you have the windows up. It's the same mm-hmm. process. It's just you're using a car window instead of gas. They still work the same process. It still doesn't let the infrared out because it's a shortwave radiation. The heat waves don't go out.
Okay.
So that's what keeps the earth warm, and that's actually how greenhouse works. Now,
but that's
it's a combination
good thing.
Of carbon dioxide. And
if we didn't absorb solar radiation, we'd all freeze to death, wouldn't we?
Yeah, absolutely. And look what happened, and then you go back. Look at here. Let me give you an example. Greenland. They actually drilled into the ice sheet in Greenland, and what they found in like right after Mount Pinatubo, or not after Pinatubo, but after Krakatoa and Tambora, they drilled into the ice sheet in Greenland, and they found huge amounts of sulfur at those year points, like 1816 and 1883.
Mm-hmm.
That means that the sulfur that was in the atmosphere actually was taken down by the snow and became part of the geologic record in that glacier. So you can go directly to there.
But those things are heavier than air. We figured out that carbon dioxide is heavier than air. Air is mostly nitrogen, so it's only two atoms. Nitrogen's pretty low on the atomic scale, and so most things are going to be heavier than nitrogen. So carbon dioxide is going to descend out, and sulfur dioxide, and all these different things that are heavier than the air eventually are going to settle back to Earth, right?
Well, here's the interesting thing. You can correlate the eruptions with the amount of sulfur found in the glaciers and the worldwide temperature. When you start correlating all those things, you can see how Mother Nature, whichever we choose to believe, the will of God, whatever, actually lowers the temperature, not man. Man had nothing to do with influencing temperature. That was the Earth. Mm-hmm. And this whole idea that somehow we're going to destroy the whole world, we need to be cautious. Don't get me wrong. But let's not be stupid.
What's cautious and what's stupid? Give me some.
Stupid is having your car stop. Stupid is having your car stop at every stoplight. Your engine stop, and then you got to figure this out. Hey,
how many starts do you figure a typical starter has? And because it seems to me this is going to greatly reduce the life of your starter.
Everybody I've talked to has said that. Even the car dealers were saying, "Yeah, well, we don't know how this is going to work out." I mean, other than they'll have people coming in to buy new starters.
Yeah, we do.
Well,
yeah, we do. We know exactly how it's going to work out.
Yeah, exactly. Here's your $500 bill for your starter, your solenoid. You know, and I don't even know if it's the same anymore with all electronics, but I question it.
This is probably something we shouldn't say on the air, but is there a way to disconnect that nonsense and just let your engine keep going?
I don't know, but I know if you disconnect other pollution control devices, that's like a federal offense. So I'm not sure.
So are the cars themselves, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah,
I'm offended by the cars themselves now. So, yeah. Okay. I'm just curious.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I'm going to guess and punt and say, if it were me, I wouldn't take the chance because who knows when you get your car inspected. You know, what's going to happen? You don't know what they're sending to the federal government, but your little ID number on your car is listed with the federal government. So
we don't inspect cars
around
here, though.
Yeah,
but we don't have the inspections. Like California, we had inspections every other year. You had to, your car had to meet the pollution standards of when it was new. And I drove in 1987, which was impossible to meet. we did it. but I had to buy a new catalytic converter every 2 years just because that's the only way we could meet the standards. Yeah.
Yeah, and catalytic converters are $900 to $1,000 a piece.
No kidding.
Because they have platinum. Yeah, they have platinum in them.
Cheaper than a new car, though.
Oh, that's true. I cringe every month I make that payment. But when it comes to the environment and the atmosphere, nobody I don't know of anybody, especially those of us that are conservatives, who don't want to be safe with the environment, but not be stupid. Not be to the point to where gasoline taxes rob. I mean, we're getting robbed at the pump now. Imagine what they will do as time goes on. And
well, this is
global.
This is what I mean between safe and stupid. There's no reason to regulate carbon dioxide at all, is there?
No, not that I can think of. I mean, when you look at how carbon dioxide plays a role in the Earth, I don't believe there is.
it's not bad for the Earth. In fact, it's critical for life on Earth to have carbon dioxide so the plants can breathe it. So how can this make any sense to anybody unless they're trying to kill us? That's the only thing I can think of. The only reason to get rid of carbon dioxide is you want everybody miserable because they don't have any fun. They don't have any industrial. We can't have the industrial revolution without carbon dioxide because internal combustion engines burning or organic fuels is basically the industrial revolution. That's what makes it go.
But
unless you're on a Stanley steamer,
The point we have to understand is that when you go back and look in glacier sediments, these glacial ice cores, we find places where the Earth's temperature, the Earth's carbon dioxide, so it's come and gone. I mean, it's gone up, gone down over time, long before man was walking on two legs.
Yeah. So according to the Earth history, which comes first? Does the temperature rise and create carbon dioxide, or does the carbon dioxide rise and create higher temperatures?
But I don't think it's necessarily a relationship like that. I don't think it's an inverse relationship. I would have to look and see. When I was looking this stuff up for our talk this morning, I was looking at totals. I was not trying to look at trends so much, but pick out points in time that I could use as an example.
I'll let you do that too. But I'm pretty sure, from what I understand from Gregory Wright Stone and the CO2 Coalition, that temperature rises precede increases in CO2. And the reason that's critical is because it completely makes irrational the argument that, A, we have to change the temperature of the Earth, and B, that reducing CO2 is going to do that. All reducing CO2 is going to do is starve the plants and make green areas deserts again because they're now greening. If we get too little carbon dioxide, it was interesting that Gregory Wrightstone was saying that 150 parts per million is death. And we were like 200 or 300 parts per million until recently. We've actually been increasing carbon dioxide, which is good. But these idiots, these maniacs, these insane people that want to get us down, if they get us down to 150 parts per million again, it's all over. Life ends, as far as they're predicting. That would be the real end of the Earth, not because of, too much carbon dioxide, but because of too little. And they've got it backwards.
And they don't pay attention to history. It's like they've forgotten. It's like all the scientific data from the last 200 years is gone. It doesn't exist. All this evidence of glacier cores and the Earth's temperatures and the Earth history, it's like they've ignored it. Uniformitarianism, the idea that the processes that are on Earth working today are the same ones that were working a million years ago. Which if you look at the record and the geologic history, mass extinctions. It wasn't man that caused those. What else happened? This whole idea of ignoring the past history.
Yeah. So what are some of the high points in history that you found?
The volcanic eruptions. That was one of the things I was trying to correlate between that, what happened with temperature in the Earth's atmosphere, and then the anecdotal things like the year without a summer and, the Krakatoa with the orange sunsets. When you start to put all that together, that provides a picture for people. That way you don't have to just go give them just cold, hard statistics. You give them relatable ideas, relatable examples. That's what I did as a teacher. You can't just give kids numbers and expect them to understand it. And it's the same with any human being. Just don't give numbers. Give examples. Give ways to illustrate what you're talking about. The leftists don't do that.
Pianki, do you have a question?
Volcanic eruptions would be very, very devastating, causing a winter with sunshine,
global
sunlight does not penetrate. And there's another thing, too. How about near misses from asteroids that would have a gravitational effect on our atmosphere and suck off some of it, thus causing a greater problem?
I think if they got that close, though, I don't think we'd have to worry about them sucking off the atmosphere. I think it would just suck.
that's true, yeah. What about...
if the asteroid got that close, yeah.
Yeah. Well, what would happen if an asteroid hit us? Have you... I've seen the pictures. I mean, I know roughly about it, but I don't think a lot of people quite understand, how fast, how much, compared to, nuclear bombs and things. If an asteroid... What's one that we could tolerate? How like the Wolf Crater is it Arizona or New Mexico? How big was that asteroid?
Behringer meteorite crater in Arizona.
Okay.
The
Wolf Crater is Australia. I'm sorry, I got my craters mixed up. How big was it?
Yeah. Meteor Crater in Arizona is about a half a mile across, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
About a half a mile across and about 500 feet deep, if I remember correctly. I'd have to go back and look.
That's a lot of Earth. And how big was the meteor?
Oh, the one, in terms of the one that struck and they tied to the dinosaurs was Chicxulub, which is in the Yucatan Peninsula. If you look at the Yucatan Peninsula, it's kind of curved. Part of that curve, they say, was part of that asteroid that ended up altering the climate and killing the dinosaurs in the Yucatan Peninsula. And there's evidence there of an asteroid strike. It alters the atmosphere.
Have they measured how big they think it was?
The crater.
Like half a mile, a mile, 200 feet?
Oh, no. It's bigger. It would be like 3 or 4 miles. Have to be. Because when you look at the Yucatan Peninsula, and it's under the sediments there, so you don't just see it. All you see is the remnants of that curve. And if you're familiar with where I'm talking about, the Yucatan Peninsula kind of cuts back north. If you look in that area on a map, you'll see it. You can see where the curve, what caused it. An asteroid's a likely suspect. And there's some other places, too. In northern England, they found evidence of a large, giant iron asteroid that struck there. There are some iron mines in northern England, and they think that an asteroid was what created those iron deposits. So it's kind of interesting when you start looking at all this stuff.
Alien iron? That's kind of interesting.
I'm afraid
some of those asteroids are big as a state.
Yeah, it'll make it, but the alien iron makes my Bandit Trans Am run faster. So that's why I need to. That's why I use
asteroids are as large as the state of Maine.
Well, yeah, and we've got a whole belt of them. We've got the Van Allen belt. We've got asteroids around, what is it, just outside Jupiter, between Jupiter and Saturn? Isn't that where the belt is?
Now, the Van Allen, get little correction here. The Van Allen is the radiation belt. The asteroid belt, which is between Mars and Jupiter, but they're where they think a planet may or may not have formed, or two may have collided. The what starts them tumbling towards the sun, something usually they run into each other. There's any number of possibilities. So we're basically like a shooting gallery. The Earth is going around the sun, and we're basically a target. Now, are there as many? Yeah, I know. It's like you're at the local fair. Okay. The amount of asteroids and meteoroids that are in space is much less than it was, say, 10, 20 million years ago, because they've fallen towards the sun or they were swept up by other planets or whatever. All you got to do is look at the surface of the moon and Mars.
Yep.
You take a look at the on the moon, the basins were created by large, huge meteorite or asteroid impacts.
Right.
So that gives you an idea that the lunar seas, those are actually craters. So when you think about the size of that on the moon, imagine that hitting the Earth.
Okay, I think about this for a second.
It would not be a good day.
Now, we're looking at the moon. Now, the moon doesn't rotate, right? So the craters that we're seeing are facing Earth all the time. Oh, it does rotate.
It rotates at the same rate it revolves. That's why you only see one side of the moon. It actually rotates.
The moon does rotate.
Yeah, and revolve at the same rate.
Okay, wait a minute. One at a time.
At 29 and a half days. That's why you can do it yourself. If you walk around your studio and you keep facing a desk, in order for you to keep facing the desk, you would have to turn on your axis a quarter for each quarter of the circle to get back to where you were. And then
there's a car alarm outside. I don't know if anybody can hear that on my over the microphone. But, yeah, it's really noisy.
I think it's like the FBI coming.
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, I'm convinced the FBI, KGB is going to either call or drop in one day, but, you know, just based on what we talk about. There's a lot of noise out there. I apologize for it. I don't know what to do. You know,
that's
there
okay.
We go. Okay. Yeah.
That's okay. Life happens, you know?
Yeah, we have
but
a lot
anyway,
of we have
yeah,
other noise
moon,
from other people, but yeah.
Yeah. The moon, the same side of the moon always faces the Earth. That's where you get the idea of Pink Floyd's album, The Dark Side of the Moon.
Well, what I was thinking of is
that's
if the Earth is, if the moon's always facing the sun, how would asteroids hit that side of it? That's what I was curious about.
They can come from any direction. It just as long as they're
in
motion, they're falling. And
they can come from
Yeah. Plus, remember, the most modern theory right now is the moon was actually part of the Earth and actually split off as the solar system was forming. The moon was not captured. The moon was not a separate entity. It actually came from the Earth as part of the Earth's formation. So
yeah.
That's kind of out there for you to think about. So there's any number of possibilities. That's what I love about science, is you can go get into all this stuff, and then you can use it politically to help your own views, or at least try.
Well, see, now this is the problem, is the manipulation of science for a particular view. I've seen the video, the YouTube with Leonard Nimoy, who was talking about global winter. We're all going to starve to death by the year, 1992 or whatever it was. This is back in 1970 when they did this. Bunch of nonsense. Al Gore's been predicting the end of the world. Everybody predicts the end of the world. Okay, you hear enough predictions that don't happen. You say, okay, yeah, that's nice. Okay, fine. But the thing is, they use this for politics. They use this to scare people. They use this to take our cars away. They use it to deny power, to force people in electric cars in California, and then they deny the power because they only have electricity.
Yep.
So the government can use all the coal, oil, natural gas they want to generate electricity, but we can only use electricity. Well, that's wrong. That's right. Illegal. That's unconstitutional based on equal protection. How does the government have more options than we can? Well, they can't. So all this stuff is illegal that they're doing, and yet people are convinced that somehow if we don't get rid of carbon, we're all going to die. But if we do get rid of carbon, we're all going to die, and they don't know that.
Well, it's creating victims. It's back to the same age-old liberal idea that you have to make victims. You're going to be a victim unless you listen to us. You're going to be a victim unless you do what we tell you. You're going to be a victim unless you let your car stop at every stoplight. It's the same process. It's the same idea. It's what they do. And it's their only modus operandi, their only MO. They know what to do. Let's create some more victims. If you don't have an electric car, you're going to die of choking on fumes. It's the same story over and over again. It's the victim mentality. Where we conservatives tend to believe in taking care of our own and doing things for ourselves and not counting on the government to watch out for us. Drives me nuts.
Yeah, on this climate change thing, if you drain the oceans, you'd have volcanoes all over the place. If it wasn't for the water pressure preventing it.
Well, that's a whole nother subject for a whole nother hour, but... But yeah,
we'll get there.
The environment, the Earth, it's so important to understand how everything works. That's why I miss teaching. And you had mentioned, Greg, earlier about what are they doing about earth sciences now. They've put it into a small science class in most middle schools, like sixth grade. Everything's about standardized tests. Everything's about math and biology, or math and physics. Earth sciences, these kids don't get. I had to spend a month just teaching my kids the main points on the Earth: equator, axis, Tropic of Cancer, Tropic of Capricorn, all those things they have to know in order to understand how the Earth functions.
Yeah, they don't know the seasons. They don't know what summer and winter, where the sun travels, and they have no concept. They don't know longitude or latitude. They don't know... any of this stuff. They don't know the wobble. They don't know, the basics of physics. They have no clue. They don't know where they are in the solar system, where the solar system is in the galaxy. They have no clue. They don't know where we are.
We have adults who think that the Earth's distance to the sun is what creates summer and winter. It's the tilt of the axis. No. They think, we're closer to the sun. Okay, from a logical standpoint, you would think we're closer to the sun, we get warmer. We're farther away, we get cooler.
What regulates our distance from the sun? If gravity is a constant, then how can we change our distance to the sun? Just a little point of scientific reference.
Mm-hmm.
Hold on, Pianki. Mike, finish your point.
We're actually closer to the sun in winter and farther away in summer in our orbit, our elliptical orbit. People don't realize that. It's the tilt of the axis that determines how warm and how cool it is.
Well, see, I thought we were pretty much constant distance the whole time. We are. So how does that bring us back then? If you're heading further away into an elliptical orbit, what brings us back? So the gravity is stronger when we're further away?
No. gravity stronger when we're closer. You've got that right. We're moving faster through our orbit the closer we are to the sun. It's, I've got to think of my numbers here. When we're closest to the sun, we're like 92 million miles. But 93 is the average. 93 is the average distance between the Earth and sun. But we're closer at what's called perihelion. That means close to the sun. Aphelion means away from the sun. So you're actually, there's two points just like apogee and perigee, the moon moving around the Earth. It's the same thing. As we go around the sun, we have a place where we're farthest away and we have a place where we're closest, because the ellipse is a combination of gravity and the Earth's momentum, Earth moving through space. That balance is an elliptical orbit. And everything, the space shuttle, the International Space Station, all of those move in relatively elliptical orbits. They're going to go a little bit faster and then a little bit slower, because that maintains a steady distance. That's what allows you to do that. Hmm. It's pretty interesting. It's kind of crazy. Go ahead.
And that tilt is what, about 22 and a half degrees?
23, you're close. 23 and a half. It's 1 degree. 23 and a half degrees.
And another thing, too, that people don't understand, they think that north is always up. other words, asteroid wouldn't land and wouldn't hit the what we call the South Pole, but they do. They can hit any place on the Earth, like you said, mentioned before. When people understand, like some people say, why does the Nile River flow from the bottom of the planet to the top of the planet? And not knowing that the water flows from high areas to low areas.
And you know what? If you grew up next to the Mississippi River, guess what you would think? All rivers flow south.
Yeah.
Here's the question. If you live to the Nile. If you live next to the Nile River, you would think all rivers flow north. I mean, when you look at a map, it's usually of the United States, and it's usually the Missouri and Mississippi rivers being the main rivers, they flow south. So what do people think? All rivers flow south. That's a concept. You tell that to a room of 13-year-olds, and they look at you like you're an alien.
Oh, yeah.
They look at you like you have three heads.
Here's a question. How come the Panama Canal, they have a series of locks, because the Atlantic and the Pacific are different levels? So how is it that sea level is at two different levels between the Atlantic and the Pacific? And why doesn't the water wash further? I forget which one's the higher one. I think it's the Pacific.
Pacific is, because I think you lock down as you go towards the Atlantic side. I'm trying to remember. There is a scientific concept, and I can't think of it right now. I see the picture of the locks, and I see the Panama Canal and how it, you lock back and forth. But I can't remember the reason. It has something to do with the elevation.
The Panama Canal is on a mountain. Yeah, it's on a mountain.
Yeah.
No, it's not.
It's mountain.
I've been through it.
Well, no.
Yes, it is. The ground is higher.
The ground elevation is higher. If you take a look at a map, look up the Panama Canal, like if they have a map view, I think it'll show that the left going west to east, you're dropping. And I think the reason you're dropping is because the elevation of the Earth, not the elevation of the water. It has to do with the way the Earth works. I'll have to look it up. I promise you.
Well, there's a series of locks that either – I sailed through the Panama Canal when I came to the United States from Australia. And I remember there was locks at both ends. And so you kind of raise up, and then you – I think, the water is higher, and you sail this long canal for a day. It's kind of fun being inland. And then you get to the other end of it, and they lower you back down again. And then off you go into the ocean. So I think the canal itself
is
higher.
What come all the fog that used to, not the fog, but the pollution used to occur in Los Angeles, that's because it's low elevation.
Well, no, that's the San Gabriel Mountains. And I flew into L.A. in 1970 in one of the first 747 flights. And it was this gray, black cloud. It looked like the worst forest fire or volcanic eruption. It looked like something. And it was solid. It was a very flat layer. The San Gabriel Mountains are 8,000 feet. And so what happens is, as the wind comes off the ocean, which it does in the Bay Area too, but our mountains are only 2,500 feet, so you don't have the same phenomena. But you got an 8,000-foot bowl around Los Angeles, and that's high enough that the pollution stays within the L.A. basin. I mean, literally, it's a basin, right? You got mountains on all sides of it, And so when the air comes in and all that smog, you got the, especially on the high pressure. So you got high pressure pushing down from above. You've got pressure, you've got wind pressure moving in from the west. You got low pressure on the other side of the mountains driving it in because the hot desert air rises. The air comes in off the ocean and it's trapped against these 8,000 foot mountains, and the high pressure above pushing down keeps it all the pollution in LA. That's what happened. So they had to clean the air. Now the air is what, 1,000 times cleaner now?
It's like a clean. Yeah, it's like a permanent temperature inversion.
Yeah.
In other words, that they don't allow the air to circulate. And as a result, you get that trapping effect where it's all caught in the Sacramento. I think that's the Sacramento Valley, isn't it?
No, Sacramento's up north.
I don't know.
No, this is, no, San Joaquin Valley is the central, and Sacramento's up north of San Francisco. Yeah. I was in California for too long. Yeah. San Gabriel's right outside
Gabriel
LA.
Mountain, right?
Yep.
Okay. I didn't know for sure. I was trying to. I'm not a California guy, so.
I was.
My
until California became a bunch of Marxists and homeless people, Marxist high techs and homeless people. That is basically California.
But you too can own a $60,000 electric vehicle.
And not use it.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay,
let's
forecast a little bit here. How much carbon are these electric power plants burning in order to create the electricity for electric cars compared to how much carbon we'd be emitting? And I still think carbon is essential. From what I've read, we need carbon. But just to use the leftist argument, how much carbon are they creating in the power plants to how much they think they're saving in the cars? Or is
there
it more carbon?
Some studies,
okay, go ahead.
There are some studies going on right now, but I have not seen the numbers. But there are people trying to work those numbers out as we speak.
Take
and
a guess.
Try to
what
figure out.
What do you think?
Oh, God. Three or four times.
So three or four times more carbon has
more.
To be burned to create electricity than burning your organic fuels directly in your automobile.
Yeah, unless you use nuclear power plants, and we know how people feel about those.
No, those are great.
People
I love nuclear power plants. Yeah, but
well, people have still been Chernobylized. They're still, you know,
yeah,
they've all been Chernobylized ever since the HBO special. It's like, we're not touching nuclear power.
Oh yeah, China syndrome. Yeah, that ruined everybody. Now it's interesting because I was in college when Three Mile Island happened, and we filled our gas tanks. We packed a bag. And if that radiation ever let loose like Chernobyl, we all had plans to leave because we were up in the Connecticut Valley. We were downwind from Three Mile Island. And so we weren't panicked, but we were aware. And we had our gas tanks and we had our bag packed in case we had to leave. So, you know, I mean, I understand that. Yeah. It's funny. I've been in a bunch of disasters. We should trade disasters. So for me, the blizzard of 78 New England, I was there for that. I was there for Three Mile Island. I was just up the river about 600 miles, whatever. I was just up the river from that. I was in the earthquake of San Francisco in 89, and I got Hurricane Sally here last year. So I haven't been in a volcano or a flood
I'll
yet.
Move
but, you know,
I'm not getting near you.
That's what everybody's
Remind me not to stand next to you in a lightning storm.
Oh yeah, that was you know that's next. You know. All right. And we've had we've had lightning strikes take the show out. In fact, we had one in the springtime. We had a lightning strike probably in like 30 feet of my house. Probably hit the transformer and the show just went. You know, I restarted it, but the power was out, the show was out, everything went out. So I don't know. I'm getting the lightning rod. Yeah. But
I think it was. It was that liberal lightning people. That's what
they were after me. Yeah, so they're trying to bring God in against it. Well, it's not going to work. You know, God likes action radio. You know, what would Jesus do?
Right.
Would Jesus like action radio? Okay, so to answer the perennial question. But if these people actually get their wish, carbon, there is no carbon. There's net zero. We're not putting out any carbon at all. What do they think is going to happen?
I don't know, because we're a carbon-based life form. I mean,
well, that's my question.
You know,
it's a rhetorical question. But what let's try and think like liberals, if that's possible. So what is it about getting rid of carbon that so fascinates them? What do they think is going to happen? What do they think they're going to accomplish with this whole net zero idea?
I don't think it's about the carbon. I think we can substitute another C word. It's called control.
Or communism. That was the one that came to mind. Okay. All right.
Control, when you think about how better can you control people, where they go, what they do, besides their vehicles. We're a mobile society. We come and go. We move. We've done it since they moved west.
Mm-hmm.
And what better way to control people than to say, well, you can't travel more than 300 miles from home or you're going to need an extension cord or something, you know, something
yeah.
like that. Hell of an extension cord. But you get my idea. It, uh-huh. it controls you. It allows you to be able to direct where people go and how they go about it. And you control it by the price, you know, that you can control the price of cars. You can, I mean, let's be honest, all the pollution devices on your cars now cost you extra money. You're paying for that when you buy that new car or truck or whatever.
Yeah.
So I think it's about control. I don't think it's got anything to do with carbon. I think it has to do with them being able to tell us what to do and how to do it. Indirectly, they're not.
No, I think it might be directly. I think you're onto something. I was just trying to, you know, I've heard that argument. I've made that argument. What I'm trying to do is trying to understand if some of these people actually believe that limiting carbon is essential. Otherwise, we all die. What are they actually thinking? And what do they think is going to happen? You know, when we don't if we're in a situation where we're not emitting any carbon, do they think everything's going to be wonderful and better? What do they actually think is going to happen? That's what I'm curious about.
I don't think there may be some of them that are think they're what's the term I want to use? They think they're being altruistic, that they're doing it for a noble goal and purpose, when I think there's people behind them realizing that it's a way to control people. They may have some young people that are foolish enough to believe that it's about the environment. I'm
mm-hmm.
starting to think that's not the case. I'm starting to think it's more of a way to control the population. Keep them from going places. Keep them from doing things. You know, it's only a matter of time.
Why would people think that's a good idea? You know, I'm trying to get in the leftist mind again. Why do they think that that's a good idea? That if they can have us live in community housing and take public transit and work in these planned communities, this goes back to smart growth in the 90s. It's the same. It's a smart growth argument with a lot of fear added to it. It's the same planned urban. But why?
Let me back up.
Okay.
Let's go back to a gentleman, the three initials, LBJ. And
okay.
let's talk about the Great Society. What was it that he was trying to do? He was trying to put all America's poor into large, multi-story housing complexes.
Hmm.
We know how that turned out, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in St. Louis, because I lived it, but in other places as well. That was an attempt to control, quote, the poor people, or to under the guise of we're going to give you a place to live. We're going to give you all this. Yeah, well, we know how that turned out.
Hmm.
And I think this is, again, another attempt to manipulate or control through people's vehicles.
Hmm.
I think that's the way to do it. And it's unfortunate, and it's sad that that happened that way, but I've seen it once before. I've seen this, and it's the same story, different chapter.
Where have you seen it before?
I think that.
Where have you seen this before?
Well, in terms of picking on, you know, the poor folks and saying, well, we're going to provide you with everything you need. We're going to provide you with transportation. We're going to provide you with a place to live and do all this. And how did you control folks by money? By having those places. Now, how do we control folks? Buy their cars.
In St. Louis. It was Pruitt-Igoe.
Yep. And he knows, you know too well where I was going with that, didn't you? Exactly. He knew.
Yeah,
he knows exactly what I'm talking about.
Pruitt-Igoe was for blacks.
Yep. And it was a failed crime, really bad situation.
It was fail. It was crime ridden, and health departments and everything else. Apartments windows broke. The winter come, they freeze. Water pipes burst. Water come pouring down onto residents below. So it was just. And it was actually built to gain favor with the labor unions, especially the bricklayers.
And what was this place called
mm-hmm.
again? I'm not familiar.
Pruitt-Igoe.
Project called Pruitt-Igoe. They're on Jefferson, Cass
mm-hmm.
Avenue, a little bit off of Washington Avenue. Yeah, that was. I know it very well.
Yep. North City and just north of the Arch and Bush Stadium. north going out that direction into St. Louis and out of St. Louis into St. Louis County. And it was done under the guise of providing people, we're going to give you housing and all this. We're going to take care of it. You know, that's what the government's saying. We're going to take care of the environment. We're going to make sure your car is electric. I'm sorry, I'm not buying it. I'm not buying it. And he's absolutely correct. The government tried to control and guide people into these housing projects. Well,
look up smart growth. It's the same thing. Plan communities, work where you live, all your entertainment, all your shopping, all your public transit is going to be in this planned community so people can be controlled. Well, here's – we got to go here in a couple minutes here. But here's the last thought is that if they're taking – they're trying to force everybody into an electric car and an electric power source, my feeling is they're doing that simply because if everybody has exactly the same power source and only one power source and that power source is controlled by the government, they can absolutely meter how much power you get. Whereas with gasoline, you can buy all gasoline you want. Now, the price can go up and the price can go down. But right now, you can buy all – if you have 50 cars in your 50-car garage, you can drive all of them on the same day, and it doesn't matter. You know, but it's the electric cars. The whole purpose, I think, is monopower, which is wrong. We should have access to all forms of energy. And the second thing is that once they get everybody in electric cars, they're going to do what California's doing, and they're going to say you can't charge your electric car. So they give you a car that you can't use. And now everybody's stranded. Nobody can go anywhere. And we are all completely controlled by the control freak, obsessive leftists that think that the world would be a great place if everybody but them is controlled. That's where I think we're going with this. It's not that they want us driving electric cars. They don't want us driving cars at all. I think that's what the ultimate goal is. Yeah. Okay. Agreed?
Give the man a cigar. You are absolutely correct. It's about control. And they use the guise of the environment. We're saving the environment. We're keeping everything green, but screw you.
Carbon dioxide keeps things green. Yeah, carbon dioxide keeps things green. Yeah, okay. Michael, thank you. And we can do this another time. This is kind of fun. It's we haven't had a good climate, hash out for a while here. Folks want to, share the show, share with your students or former students. I'd be curious to see what they think of it. This is interesting.
Yeah, I am going to, let me tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to do some quick research for you. I'm going to get those totals on carbon and find out about, electric car versus regular car versus, I'm going to look that stuff up for you and I'll get you the stats.
Why don't you come back next month? So take some time. There's no rush on this. Go over the podcast. Talk about all the questions we had, all the things that we didn't solve. We should probably make this a fairly regular thing because I think it would be good.
Yeah, that sounds like the plan to me.
Okay. Yeah, let's do that. Remind me when you're ready to come back.
Sounds great.
And we've got some answers, and we'll do that. Closing comments, groups you want to support, anything else on your mind, and public contact information, anything that you'd like to share at this time?
I'm on Facebook. People can get a hold of me there if they have questions about science. I certainly don't have all the answers, but I can help people find them. Also, if you have concerns about education, what are your kids learning? What are they not learning? I'd be happy to share that with you and talk with you about it and give you ways to maybe approach your school district and come up with different ways for kids to learn. I'm a little bit worried about education right now. I'm a little bit worried about what they're teaching kids. What's right, what's wrong, and the difference between the two. And
we're hurting a bunch of different countries. Like I say, we got Algeria and Uganda just pop back up on our list, as well as Latvia, Romania, Bulgaria, some other places. We got a very interesting list of the Solomon Islands listens to us. I found them on the map too. So Bahamas listens to us. Puerto Rico listens to us. Panama just popped up on the list of nations. I got a world map.
How about Bora Bora?
Bora Bora? I didn't see Bora Bora. Bora Bora is part of Indonesia, isn't it?
I believe so. I know it's in the Southwest Pacific.
Yeah, they do Indonesia as a big block. But we do have Malaysia is separate. So we got listeners in Singapore. We've got listeners, pretty much around the world. It's really quite fascinating. None in Ukraine. Borges were censored there. But what's that?
Oh, we're a Sandals location. I will be happy to broadcast from live.
We want to take some trips with Action Radio. We've got a friend of ours, Alan Dawson, is a tour guide in Belize. So we're all going to go down Belize. So any listener, welcome to reporters. Yeah, we're all going to hang down there. And
I'd be a millionaire in Belize.
What's that?
I'd be a millionaire in Belize on my teacher retirement.
There you go. You should look into it. I got a contact that I believe is beautiful. Anyway, so you better spell your name just so folks can find you. But like I say, you may get some contacts from different places.
It's Mike, M-I-K-E, and then Clinch, C-L-Y-N-C-H. You can just Google me on Facebook. That's where I have. I had a campaign website when I was formerly running for county commissioner, but that's gone. So
yep, he came to
all
his senses.
You need to do is just
decided not to serve an elected office. Yeah. Good move.
Oh, you do, yeah. Right. I wanted to preserve my marriage. All right. Sounds good, Greg. Thank you so much.
That is a good reason. Okay. Thank you, too. Let me play a couple of things here, and we'll close out the week. Pianchi, do you have any closing thoughts? Thanks, Mike. Oh, I think you just hung up.
Well, I think the effort should be to grow trees, grow grass, cover grass on the soil. That has been proven to be better than leaving it till the way it has been done.
Yep.
And if that would make a great difference. You have so many paved surfaces nowadays. Water cannot permeate through the soil back into the ground table, water table. There has to be an alteration in the way we're doing things.
Makes sense. No, I agree with you. And I think leave people alone. Freedom works. Freedom provides the best environments. Freedom provides the most mobility, the happiest people. Freedom provides the most interesting cars. You know, government, just shut the hell up and go away. You know, just stop doing stuff. Stop spending our money. Just stop doing stuff. Stop. Carbon will take care of itself. The carbon cycle works very well. It's all been pre-done. You don't have to worry about it. So leave carbon alone. Leave us alone. Leave everything alone that you can. And if you know, protection of property and preservation of rights, that's it. Anything else other than that, just stop doing it. That's my vote on that. All right, let's do it again next week. And this has been an incredible week. Yesterday, we rewrote a bill. Judy Mikovits and a regular listener wrote a bill to ban drug advertising. Wednesday, we had Captain Tom Stewart and Dr. Sandy Majorecki with folks that have been kicked out of the military because they won't take an unapproved vaccine, which is not even a vaccine. This has been an interesting week. And I like doing this, and we'll keep doing it. All right, let me play something here. Come back for a little bit at the end, and we shall do it again next week. Our normal Monday start time now is 7 a.m. Central Time.
This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, insights into our founding documents, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers here in Santa Rosa County, Florida. Santa Rosa Volunteers is available at their website, srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. There is no separation of church and state in the Constitution. Therefore, the Supreme Court can't imagine that it really is there or should be there, so they can't create the rule out of thin air and then enforce it as if it actually did exist. The biggest problem with the controversy between Thomas Jefferson, then president, and the Danbury, Connecticut Baptists, a religious minority, is that everyone focuses on the answer by Thomas Jefferson, saying there is a wall of separation between church and state, but they never consider the request made by the Danbury Baptists that Jefferson sought to answer, and therefore where the wall of separation actually is. If you only have the answer, then you can make the question anything you want, including making the question fit the answer to advance an agenda or denying that there even is a question. The question now is whether the government is free from any of the moral constraints or persuasiveness of religion, such that religion and government are walled off in isolation from each other, so that government can contemplate and implement any power for themselves without any organized religious participation, debate, opinion, objection, or protest. That is a complete bastardization of the exchange between Jefferson and the Baptists, and it has been used to advance a bogus set of laws and court opinions. The background for this controversy comes from the article mentioned below, which says, "The First Amendment was meant as a limit on the National Congress only. Madison wanted limits on the states too, but they were rejected. State limitations on religious liberty and establishment persisted after the First Amendment was adopted. Religious tests for office remained in place in most states, and Connecticut, 1818, and Massachusetts, in 1833, did not disestablish their official state churches until decades later. The Supreme Court reinforced the idea that the Bill of Rights did not apply to the states but rather only to the national government in Barron v. Baltimore in 1833. Back to me. Where this becomes especially critical is when the states, not the state as in government in general, but the individual states, establish their own religion and churches because they were not subject yet to the First Amendment. It is in that context that Jefferson is responding to the Danbury Baptists. The key part of the Danbury Baptist letter to Jefferson is this clause. What religious privileges we enjoy as a minor part of the state, we enjoy as favors granted and not as inalienable rights. And these favors we receive at the expense of such degrading acknowledgments as are inconsistent with the rights of free men. The Danbury Baptists, being a religious minority in a larger group of Congregationalists, which was the state religion of Connecticut, were being discriminated against for not being part of the state religion. And because the First Amendment only referred to Congress making no law regarding the establishment of a government religion, but left the states free to do so, we had religious freedom at the federal level, but privilege and discrimination at the state level. That is why the Danbury Baptists wrote Jefferson. Now Jefferson's response makes sense. He says to the Baptists, believing with you that religion is a matter which lies solely between man and his God, that he owes account to none other for his faith or his worship, that the legitimate powers of government reach actions only and not opinions, I contemplate with sovereign reverence that act of the whole American people which declared that their legislature should make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state. Put in modern English, the individual relationship between man and God is direct, and the wall of separation is so that the government never crosses that wall between individuals, their churches, and God, with state religions, state churches, religious laws and tests, religious qualifications for office, etc., etc. However, there is nothing in law or the Constitution preventing churches, religions, and religious individuals like pastors, priests, ministers, etc., and just regular folks too, from exercising moral persuasion, evaluation, and criticism over government, because the free exercise of religion also includes the redress of government for grievances. The wall of separation of which Jefferson spoke only works one way. To understand Jefferson and the Baptists, it's not the wall of separation between church and state, it's the wall of separation between the free exercise of religion and any state established religion. That's it. Everything else is agenda-driven narrative. The source for the Federalist Papers is federalistpapers.org. The Anti-Federalist Papers are from selfeducatedamerican.com. The Articles of Confederation are from usconstitution.net. This episode also used Thomas Jefferson's misunderstood letter to the Danbury Baptists from the Washington, Jefferson, and Madison Institute website. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers. Their website is srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Please share this report to anyone who needs it. This is Greg Penglis. So what is Action Radio? It is a radio show with its own citizen legislature. That's you, the listener. It is a fully interactive system of listeners, expert guests, social media, writing bills, legislator input, bill submission, lobbying, and citizen action. Action Radio is the future of talk radio, using all the available technology in one completely integrated new system. You are listening to Action Radio Online with Greg Penglis.
The webpage for all Action Radio shows and podcasts is blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction. Please share our show with all your friends and family, both nationally and internationally. The guiding principle of Action Radio is this: we the people give our consent to be governed through writing the laws by which we are governed.